Howdy folks, this is Tom Bartley here. You may be wondering why it's taken an inordinately long amount of time for Model Rail Radio to come out. Well, unfortunately, as I was recording this show, and it was recorded to about 6 hours, I went back and listened to my audio specifically, and there was a horrible kind of clicking noise throughout a majority of my audio. So, as you know, I'm a bit of a perfectionist with regards to these kind of things, so I've gone the extra yard and actually re-recorded a good amount of my own audio through this show. In large part, so I actually make some sense, because when I edited it down to actually remove the noise, the kind of clicking noise, basically I didn't make a lot of sense. So there are some large tracks here where I just talk about things and things like that, and other sections where I've just edited out my audio. And I really am very sorry for the quality of this podcast, because I think the quality of listener-contributed content is particularly high in this show, but due to the issues associated with the audio noise on my end, it's been cut down a little bit. So apologies for folks who participated, and if you don't hear your audio in this show, unfortunately it's probably due to the fact of the noise overlay. But anyway, please do tune in. It's a regular Model Rail Radio, except with some pretty savage editing. Tom Bartley, now in the Bay Area, signing out. Welcome to Model Rail Radio. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is being recorded live on Skype, October 29th, 2011. Model Rail Radio is the internet's only live recorded radio show where the topic is the hobby of model railroading. And it's with great pleasure I have the chance to talk to Terry Terrence. Hello, Terry.
Hey, how are you today, Tom?
Pretty good, pretty good. So we've had overwhelming feedback associated with doing the show on Skype. It's all been very positive, and I think the general consensus is the audio quality is better, and potentially, from my end, and I'm the only one that ever sees the edits, but it's a lot easier to do editing with the Skype quality audio because you're eliminating a lot less strange noise which seemed to creep into TalkShoe. So I think going forward what we're going to be doing is recording on Skype, and the way to do that is just add me on Skype, which is tom.barbalay. The information is all on the front page of the Model Rail Radio website. And then just call me during the show, and I'll add you in. We may be mid-discussion, which certainly was the experience last show, but add me in, and, call me through Skype. I'll add you into the conversation, and then it'll just be like a regular Model Rail Radio. Certainly the same chat session was going on while we were recording last show, and, in general, it just felt like a regular Model Rail Radio recording with the difference that we were doing it through Skype. So the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. People like the format, and they like the audio quality. There was some question associated with the number of people that we can get on Skype. I think we had more than 12 last show. I want to say it was even close to 20 in some stages. It worked out fine. So let's keep pushing the boundaries. I mean, if we're going to be testing out Skype like we tested out TalkShoe, so much the better. But Terry, it's been a while since I last chatted with you. I mean, I'm not sure whether it's been 2 weeks or 4 weeks. What's been going on in your hobby since we last spoke?
Well, I think mostly what I've been doing is building some models, and doing some other things, trying to keep a few entries in on my blog. I'm building a resin boxcar kit, which this particular kit is about 20 years old. It actually has a 1988 date in the instructions.
Gosh.
It's one of the Chooch kits. Mm-hmm. And pretty much... the older Chooch kits, you didn't get a one-piece body. You got four walls and some material to build the roof. And so I'm very, very slowly, you know, putting this all together, and they don't give you quite all the parts. So you have to order some brake rigging parts and some grab iron. So while I'm waiting for all that to come in, I'm putting on the parts that I do have. I happen to have some stirrup steps in stock, and I had to redo the ladders because the ladders they gave, I, you know, broke them. So, but it's coming along, and it should be a very interesting car when it's assembled. It's an outside brace box car, which there are now some available from Atlas, but at one time in O scale, they were, you know, Chooch was pretty much the only ones. Chooch and the older wooden kits were the only ways you could get an outside brace box car. And in the transition period, outside brace box cars were actually quite common on the rails. They weren't all the standard, you know, steel, you know, all the same height, all the same width box cars in the early 50s. There were still a lot of these outside brace cars around, which give you some variation to the skyline in the train as it goes by. So
it is a critical feature, actually. It's something that I noticed. I'm going to talk a little bit about my past couple of weeks because it's been relatively model railroading intensive, actually. But it is something that I've even noticed, even on modern layouts, that people do like to have a variety of different sizes, for want of a better term, a box car. But a quick question for you. In terms of O scale, modelling in wood for the braced box cars, is that preferential for some? I'm thinking for your era, probably it was moving heavily into steel for a lot of the visible parts, particularly, I guess, with braced box cars. But is there some preference for using wood in order to get particular effects on the box cars?
I don't think so. Many, many people now build in styrene. If you look at, especially a lot of the forums, you see most people are building in styrene and they've eschewed wood. I think it was last year, I completed one of these ancient kits that I've had since, you know, I was a much younger man. And has been hanging around. And in fact, this particular kit I started over 20 years ago, put it aside, and I finally decided, hey, I better finish this thing. And it's an older wood kit with literally, it was a few scribe siding pieces, which were pre-printed, you know, look like with pen and ink, and lots of bunches of strip wood and some fairly sketchy instructions as to how to complete the boxcar. But overall, it was actually quite a bit of fun. Fortunately, I had done the two most tedious jobs 20 years ago when I had a little bit more time and patience, which was to do the underframe, which had to be built up from individual pieces. So it's a center sill car, so you had to build those center sills with the cap, you know, pieces and everything. And then the roof was made up of, you know, some pieces, and you had to put in all the roof ribs. So I had done that, and so therefore I said, well, the rest of it can't be too bad. So I finished it off. It's still waiting for some grab irons, but when these grab irons come in, I'll finish both of these cars at once and do the final painting and put them on the layout.
I'm not sure if it's due to your very generous and thankful donation to my introduction to O, but I certainly get the sense that O scale has a far longer tail associated with, as you say, building kits that are from the, you know, from 20 plus years ago. In fact, when I started investigating O scale, having received your wonderful parcel, I realised that the potential for buying, as you say, kits from the 80s, even the 70s and back, and doing customized modifications and these kind of things were a lot more accessible to O scalers than, well, certainly in N, but also in HO as well. Do you get the sense that it just has a longer tail, O scale, in terms of what you can grab from the past, so to speak, and modernize?
I think it does, because for whatever reason, I think you have more people who are hoarders in O scale.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty impressive HO hoarding in the past couple of weeks, but that's another story.
Oh, yes. Well, I was at an O-scale, two-rail O-scale train show last Saturday, and there was a younger guy. By younger, I mean someone is in his 30s, and a bunch of us, you know, old gray beards were sitting around, and the young guy said, well, you know, I have almost 100 cars, and I said, piker, you know. People collect all this stuff on the someday I'm going to build this. And literally what happens, and it's somewhat sad, And you can see that the O scale shows, you know, some guy, you know, basically passes on before any large percentage of these kits are built. Mm. And you can easily pick up kits that were manufactured in the 40s and the 50s, gosh, 60s and 70s with, you know, that at any given show. And it's not going to get any better, because now that you have Atlas O coming out with absolutely beautiful cars in plastic. And this was a topic of discussion we had last week, and it was the topic of the editorial in the most recent O Scale Trains magazine, is ready to one run versus kit built. And it's, you know, the same argument is raging in HO to some extent. But with all these beautiful ready-to-run cars coming out, we don't have as many in O as you do in HO, but we still have a good supply from Atlas and a Weaver. So you can basically buy all your rolling stock, take it out of the box, put it on the rails. And O Scale Trains was bemoaning that development, but more people now have time to build layouts instead of time building the models, hopefully, so that you can run a layout. And I think, you know, the argument about, you know, modeling with your wallet versus modeling with your hands and your skills and developing skills may be something of a false argument. You can now spend time on layouts and electronics and scenery and all those other things that people never got around to. They had a closet full of models that they meticulously built over the years and had nowhere to show them. So, you know, I'm sort of halfway in the middle. I am putting, for the most part, you know, when I need another car on the layout, like I needed back in September, so it wasn't quite so sparse when I had my open house, I went in and I got all the pre-built models and just put them on the rails. Okay. And they're not weathered, but they at least we had some trains running around. But in the background, I'm slowly building up the kits, and I have probably about 50-50, 60-40, you know, kits to built up models. So my plan is to, you know, start out with the ready-to-runs, but infiltrate the kits as they get built. And that, you're right, with a kit, you have a chance to modify something. So, for instance, the cars I build usually don't wind up exactly the way the kit builder intended. I'll do things, you know, little cheats like substituting a complete set of plastic brake rigging from Intermountain, simply because I'm not going to sit there with individual pieces of wire and rig up the brake rigging. On this current kit from Chooch, they want you to build the roof out of styrene, and I don't think so. I'm going to go get an Intermountain plastic roof,
yes,
and put it on the car, simply because it's a time versus effort trade-off. Now, I have a couple of these kits, and I'm building up this first one. I could say, I'm looking and saying, you know, gee, I could turn this into a contest quality model if I did this, that, and the other. And that will happen in the future. I will build up one of these kits as a contest quality model and see how I fare at one of the contests. But I'm not ready to do that right now. But at least I'm making the mental notes. Okay, I can do this better. I can do this differently. I can add some more detail here. I can put, you know, cut levers. I can rework some of the rivet detail and turn this into a really, really nice model, because the basic castings are quite nice. You know, they put some variation in the boards and the sides, and, you know, the Z braces, like many cast Z braces, aren't really Z in cross section. And that's one thing I could do with styrene that would turn into a contest quality model. I actually have Z bracing, which is a Z in cross section. So there are a lot of things you can do to take a relatively old school resin kit and turn it into a contest quality model. And I'm sure if Clark were on, he'd probably be egging me on and talking about Master Model Railroader and all that sort of stuff. But you know, he's essentially right. You know, you can use that as a basis to hone your skills. And I think that's where the editorial in O Scale Trains, which came down heavily on the craftsman side, misses the point. Yeah. It's not either or. It's not binary.
Certainly.
Okay. You don't have to either be a ready-to-run guy or a craftsman kit guy. You can blend the two approaches to modeling to suit your time and ambition and, you know, level of skill and level of funding. You know, nobody, well, I won't say nobody, but very few people can afford to, you know, buy everything ready to run. It just gets too expensive. Although there are people out there, and you see them all the time, who are buying these custom built layouts. In fact, there was one on an O scale board which was absolutely huge. I mean, it was like supermarket size.
Gosh.
This guy's building, and he's having it built for him. Okay. It's absolutely mind boggling. In fact, if I can figure out how to use the chat here on Skype, I'll see if I can dig up that the link to that and post it. But you know, that's one extreme. You know, at the other extreme, we have, you know, the people like Jim, who are, you know, P48, who would rather have, you know, less than 100 square feet of layout, but it's going to be built to the highest standards. Okay.
Yes, I was going to roll into the P48 discussion, because obviously taking things to extremes and talking about old kits in particular and modernize them, but not only modernize them, then move them to a degree of realism that for many of us is quite extreme. But you also raised another issue that I wanted to talk about, because certainly seeing a lot of HO layouts, as I have in the past, well, not a lot, but enough to get me thinking about HO as a scale. My sense with regards to it is that I did really like the other stuff that you sent me, and I thought, if given the space, would I choose an HO layout? And this is another discussion that I have with Matt Goodman, particularly about helixes. I may, at one stage in my life in the future, have enough space, but in the short term, I would probably have at least 14 to, you know, 15 feet that I could do a small O switcher on. And mm-hmm. I guess what you are describing the two possibilities here. On one side, stadium size layout. And it's funny, actually, there was a fellow who contacted me through the week, and he has purchased or he's rented, and you describe an old supermarket space. This is exactly, I think, what he's picked up. Anyway, he has this huge space, and he wants to turn it into a club, a model railroad mm-hmm. club. So he contacted me both with regards to kind of promotional advice, and also I think he wants to be on the show in the future to talk about this particular space. But it does seem, I mean, particularly with the downsizing the economy and things, the potential for clubs to pick up land that has considerable space in it. But returning to some of the discussion with O, you mentioned so many things. I've got a kind of scattershot list of questions associated with that. In terms of the regional O-scale group that you meet with, what's the diversity of layouts like in terms of space? Are there actually O-scale switcher almost shelf-style layouts?
Within the group down here in the Baltimore-Washington area, we actually run the gamut. The smallest layout I visited, and I won't say that there aren't smaller ones, but they probably don't lend themselves to a group visit, was one that's about 11 by, I think, only 18. Okay? And it fits into, you know, one corner of the basement. It doesn't take up this gentleman's whole basement, and he's done a very simple, you know, over-under loop, and he has a six-track hidden staging yard under one of the upper loops, and he can stage his trains there, run them around, and it's a very nice, tractable layout, and he's quite happy with it, and I actually like it myself. Because it's, you know, sort of something you can get your arms around. At the other extreme is a gentleman who now lives down in Williamsburg, but he did live in the immediate Baltimore, Washington area, before he moved, who has a house that I can basically, I'm surmising here, he built a house over a gigantic basement. And he's modeling the Pennsylvania Railroad, which of course is a large undertaking. Oh, and he has a very impressive horseshoe curve scene. So it runs the gamut from something that, you know, is sort of spare bedroom size or a little larger to, you know, a what must be oh gosh, probably close to 12, 15, maybe more 100 square foot basement.
Yeah.
And that's within this group. And now a lot of them, and maybe this will get back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the last show I was on, a lot of these gentlemen are in the you know, Maryland College Park area, mm-hmm. where the typical house is a small cape, about maybe 24 feet square. And as I mentioned before, this was the group that John Armstrong belonged to. So a lot of the gentlemen in this group live in houses very much like John Armstrong's. I think Armstrong's house was 27 by like 24 or something like that. It was a nearly square space, and he designed his layout to maximize the long length of run within that space. And because a lot of these people were either influenced by John or had their layouts designed by John Armstrong, a lot of them follow that same philosophy, and they're in that same size class. So they're you know, not large even by HO standards, or maybe they are large by HO standards. But it's possible to do a shelf layout in O. As a matter of fact, when Chris put up the challenge on 32 square feet, I was doodling some ideas of what you could do in 32 square feet in O by taking, you know, a sheet of plywood and cutting 19-inch or so slices out of it. So you got 5 19-inch by 4-foot pieces, and then arranging those in a 3-piece by 2-piece L would actually yield a fairly nice little O-scale switching layout. And as a matter of fact, I have a number of layout plan books here, and some of them have track plan arrangements which could fit on the two legs of that L and connected by a short section of curved track to connect what would otherwise be two disconnected switching layouts could probably yield quite a bit of fun there.
From a visual perspective, O looks a little bit more than just toy trains. It can quite comfortably be something which is aesthetically pleasing. We are in fact moving into a smaller space, and yeah, I think I'll be limited to structure kit building and other things. I received an interesting and somewhat critical email through the week, which gave me pause for thought. I'm going to remove the names and remove the companies and these kind of things, but it was from a concerned listener associated with the potential for model rail radio to turn into, and I will use his words here, an infomercial. I think the concern was that because we've had a few manufacturers on and we've had a store owner calling in, and these kind of things, that the show format, which obviously the listener was very passionately interested in, these shows would become infomercials. To be perfectly clear, I'm extremely mindful of this. Aside from my background associated with, you know, software and other things, at college I took every philosophy course that was on offer. I have a philosophy degree, and the issue of ethics and the prickly nature of ethics and morality. So it's certainly something that I've thought about quite a bit. And what I will say is, in full disclosure, if I am given any gifts or anything, I will be sure to disclose it in the show, because I'm not interested in the show being overtaken in an infomercial format. Hello, Clark.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Clark, how are you?
I'm good.
Anyway, I can't... Yep. Tom and I were talking about, you know, building versus buying, and that was a topic of the editorial page in the latest issue of O-Scale Trains magazine, and we were discussing it at an O-Scale Train show last Saturday, and it's not a binary. It's not build versus buy, although O-Scale Trains came down heavily on the side of the builders. But as I pointed out in my own case, anyway, it's both. I'm you know, putting out the ready to run cars right now because I'd rather put my time into building the layout. But I am completing kit built cars, including, you know, Craftsman style kit resin kits on the side, and I'll get there at some point.
Like you were saying about the, you know, buy versus build. I think it's a, most people, I think it's a balance of both. I know myself in the H-013, I don't even think I would bother building cars anymore because the Blackstone have everything on them. Like, why bother when I can buy a car for $40?
That's interesting, Clark, because I thought you would have been the other way with the, you know, Master Model Railroader program, that you should build them anyway to build up your skills. And I think that would be a valid argument.
I've already done it. I have the car certificate. So I, you know, I'm past that. So, but really, the amount of detail on these cars and everything, it can't add anything. I don't know if you'd ever, to be honest, get them to look as good as these cars. So, and that's one of the things that the AP program, they've had this real dilemma. I know the prototype modeler guys really get mad at the NMRA guys, the contest guys, because they say, well, sure, you're giving me points for building this, but I can buy it and it looks a lot better. Why would I build it and only have half the quality, yet you're going to ding me for points, you know? So it's kind of an interesting tussle there. But, yeah, see, I'd rather spend my time on structures rather than cars. And maybe that's a personal preference, because I know lots of guys who, like Roger Chrysler, who loves to build cars. So maybe it's just a personal preference.
No, well, you're exactly where Tom and I were discussing, is you make a decision on where you can best use your time. And that may not be in building cars, at least not at some early stage of layout development. In fact, that was what we were discussing at the show last Saturday, was more people are building layouts. And, you know, if you're going to build a layout that involves so many more things than car building or locomotive building, and at some point you may turn back to building locomotives and cars, and that's basically my philosophy. I have about half kits and half ready to run. The ready to run will get the layout up and running so I can enjoy it, so I can enjoy it with people, you know, down here who come to visit, and then eventually I'll infiltrate the car kits in and have probably the best of both worlds.
Sure. And I think that's what happens to you. You know, the first thing you got to do is the bench work, and then you got to get your track and your wiring done. And then you can run a train, and at that point you can sort of say, okay, now I can sort of ease off and do the things I'd like to do rather than the things I have to do, because the heavy construction and all the stuff to get a layout to the operating point is already done. And then you can pick and choose, say, hey, I'll maybe work on a building today, or maybe I'll build a car or something. But you don't have to do it. It's not like, you know, when you're, I have to put legs on the bench work, I have to get the wiring done, I have to get, or otherwise I just can't even run a train.
Right, precisely. Okay, and that's my view of it. It's not a binary. Either you're a craftsman or you're not, and you're buying your cars, and as somehow that's not as worthy as building them. And basically, we're building. And I guess I was thinking about something Scotty Mason said in one of his recent shows about going on and on about the military modelers and their high level of skill. But we're building a complete world. Not only are we building a complete world, we're building everything that's under that complete world that makes it work. And that's a fairly large undertaking. You mentioned bench work and wiring, and now we've added the added dimension of electronics. And all of that requires time. If nothing else, it requires time. And it also requires money. Okay, it requires money. So, you know, so we're building entire operating miniature worlds, and not just one static model surrounded by a square foot or so of diorama quality scenery. And that requires, in some cases, I believe it requires, you know, some compromises. You're not going to have diorama quality scenery. You may not have every model on the layout being, you know, a contest quality model, like a military modeler may have. But the flip side of it is we can play with our toys and they work. Okay.
That's right.
And we've got a whole working world that simulates a transportation system. And that's very rewarding. And like the military modelers, we also get satisfaction out of doing the historical research and preserving a little bit of history in our basement so that people can come down and see exactly the way it was.
That's true. That's true. There's a lot to this hobby, and you know, everybody has their own niche, and some people try to do it all, and that's okay too. But on a big layout, if you have a big layout, I don't know if you can do it all, you know, and complete a layout to a reasonable size. I think that's where a smaller layout, you can do it to a little bit more detailed degree. But then your trade-off is, you know, the long runs and so forth. So, yeah, it's always interesting to see how people approach it and what their ideas are and so forth. I know we always talk about this quite often when I give clinics and stuff. You have foreground models, you have mid-ground models, and you have background models. You know, background models may not even have a back to them because they're up against something. So you just see the fascia or the front like a true backdrop structure or something. And it just gives the appearance. Now, the foreground models may have all four walls and a nice roof. And, you know, on the outside, it's great. On the inside, there's nothing in it. And then, of course, a foreground model may be a contest type of model where everything is there and it's right on the edge of the layout. So when people come and see your layout, they see all that detail because, you know, 2 feet back, they're not going to see it. That mid-ground model is perfect. And, of course, 3.5 or 4 feet back or whatever the distance is, you don't need any detail because you can't see it. So, of course, it also changes with scale, too.
Well, that's an interesting observation because that point was made in the O-Scale Trains editorial that, you know, people are hiding behind the 3-foot rule. And it's not a question of hiding behind the 3-foot rule. It's a question of, you know, as we all get older, and certainly the O-Scale community is about as old as they come, you can't see that far. And while it may bug some people to know that the model back there against the backdrop doesn't have a back or doesn't have all the detail in it, you certainly can't claim to be able to see detail at that distance at our age. And then, of course, that gives lie to everything we've just talked about is the Franklin and South Manchester.
Yeah, that's true. I think also the type of detail that you add, and I know that may sound strange, but if you're adding paint and names such as like at South French Manchester, you've got the colors, you've got the subtle weathering, you've got all that, which in my mind is almost to a caricature point. It jumps out at you, but you know the actual nut bolt detail on something may not even see it. Because it's kind of muted into the structure, but that's all part and parcel of what you want to bring out in your model and what you want to detail. Jerry Cornwell, I think, mentioned when he was on the show some time ago about actually putting sort of a spotlight on structures or items that you want to kind of pop out to your visitors, so when somebody walks into the layout, their eyes are immediately drawn to that structure or whatever that may have phenomenal detail because you've kind of highlighted it with, I'll call it a spotlight as such, on the layout. And I know on his layout he did that in several instances, and it really works. Boy, you kind of notice it. You don't know why, but your eye is drawn to it.
Well, I've seen that done in both theatrical and museum lighting, okay, is that they will highlight, and it doesn't have to be you're putting, you know, a 10,000-watt spotlight on something, but you highlight something that so it's a little bit brighter than the rest of the background, and your eye is naturally going to be drawn to that spot of light.
Right.
That's something that is difficult to do if you're lighting your layout with linear fluorescence overall, as I am, as I've been experimenting with that, you know, and taking incandescent spots and I've even been experimenting with compact fluorescent spots and even some LED spots to see, can I, you know, highlight a certain area and make a particular area pop out from the background. And my experiments have been inconclusive. So I may be able to do it, I may not, but we can probably learn a lot from the people who light museums and the theater, because especially the theater plays a lot with light. And of course, because they have people actively up there in the rigging, they can follow around an actor with a spotlight so that the audience follows that moving object or moving person. Would be nice if we could do that with our trains.
Firstly, Clark, I have to thank you. I'm not sure, actually, Seth Newman is a long-time listener to the show. I can't recall. I think it might have been Trevor, actually, who sent out. Or maybe Seth approached me initially. Trevor introduced me to another fellow who's in the area. And again, my mind has gone blank for names. But to give some introduction to this, I had the pleasure of spending a day with Matt Goodman last weekend. In fact, last Saturday. We went to the train shop. He met you guys, actually, the week before.
Chris and I think Brian, anyway, met Matt on the Sunday, right off the plane at Credit Valley, and I was working, so I was unable to join them. And then Tuesday night, I think Chris and Matt got together on the Monday night for dinner, and probably those two guys talked to each other's ear off. And then I said, let's go for dinner on the Tuesday, and everybody said, we're all in. And so we went to a Japanese steakhouse, and we had a great dinner, and there was just the four of us. There was Brian Schilling, myself, Chris, and Matt, and I think the poor chef, because he cooks at your table, and he's doing all his things, and we were too busy talking, and I think he finally just gave up and made the dinner and said, here you go. Which was kind of funny, and but we were deep into railroading, and Chris and Matt were Chris was excellent. He gave Matt one of the books, I think, that you got, Tom, the Narrow Gauge Through the Bush. Yes. And so they exchanged a whole bunch of stuff. Then we had a little show and tell. Chris brought a few pieces of stuff, and I think it was all the 7mm British stuff that was all flat metal. So Brian and I are looking at it going, oh man, I don't need to get into something else. And then he brought out another English book that he had four or five copies of. And we all looked through that, and we had a great evening. And then after dinner, Brian and Matt came back to my house, and we sat in the layout room and just yakked and talked, and I showed them a bunch of aluminum from Fast Tracks, and we talked about my layout for a few minutes, and then it was about 1 o'clock in the morning, and Brian went home, and I took Matt back up to his hotel, which is about a half an hour away, and I was home by about 2 o'clock in the morning. Gosh. So that was our evening.
Matt and I did a number of things together, and in no particular order, we went to the train shop of Santa Clara. We then went and had lunch with Seth Newman, and then thankfully we were invited to see Seth Newman's layout, and then we went on to Ted Stevens' layout, and finally we ended up having a Thai meal and going over Matt's layout plans. So in no particular order, we started off at the train shop, and I've editorialized in previous model rail radios my concern associated with the train shop. In short, they're not particularly friendly. My last experience at the train shop was, I think, on a Tuesday morning. My brother and I were visiting the Bay Area, and I went in slightly before lunch because my brother and I had lunch plans at Apple. I went into the train shop. My brother stayed in the car. He's not a model rail enthusiast, so couldn't really ask him to come in. And the first thing that struck me was the owner and his wife were in the store alone. And I thought, okay, this is an amazing opportunity to actually talk to the owner of the store. However, he didn't really want to talk to me, and his wife was kind of a bit offhanded as well. So going this time with Matt Goodman, my anticipation was be that they might be slightly more friendly, and because we were going on a Saturday morning, I anticipated that was a particularly busy time. Truth be told, it was. There were a number of people in the train shop, and actually a number of the customers were clearly repeat customers. Matt Goodman and I struck up a conversation with a couple of them,
Our first interaction with the owner occurred after probably about 10 minutes of being in the store. Matt and I, having been through various sections of the store, we kind of stood together initially, and then I went off to explore the inn offerings, and Matt went through the store considerably more methodically. We ended up in the live steam G-scale area of the store. Matt had never actually seen the variety of live steam G-scale that they offered. Obviously, there are a variety of different scales, up to, I think, 1 to 23. I think that was probably the largest scale that we saw. But anyway, wide variety of scales, live steam G-scale stuff, or G-track. Matt pulled out his new iPhone and started creating a little narrative video. And the owner came over quite swiftly and told us that we weren't allowed to film anything in the store. Now, we both identified that we were from out of town, and Matt actually had some questions. And this was actually my experience last time going there, because I had some questions for the owner as well, and the owner quickly pushed me off to his wife, who then really didn't answer the questions and kind of disappeared halfway through. And Matt had some questions, and similarly the owner kind of took him to walk through the store. Two customers came and took the owner. In fact, I thought at one point he basically just wasn't answering Matt's question. And then we were kind of left in one section of the store. Matt did strike up a conversation with the store owner's wife. But in general, you know, it's a very nice store. There's a lot of selection, pretty reasonably priced. But the owner and his wife really, I don't know. I mean, my sense with regards to hobby stores of this quality in terms of just the amount of stuff is that the store owner needs to be relatively cheerful or at least relatively engaging. And I guess I had a similar experience as I did last time. I didn't purchase anything this time, although their quality of Union Pacific was certainly higher than the last time I was there. This is kind of your experience as well, isn't it, Clark?
No, I have the same issues. No, there's no, even I think Ted walks in there and they kind of go, okay, you know, at least they know the guy and they'll maybe grunt at him a little bit, but you know, it's they're not very friendly, and it's a shame because with that type of store, as you said, a little bit of friendliness, and they could be much more than what they are. I think in their business would improve, but on the other hand, I think sometimes they go, "Hey, listen, we got the stuff. We don't have to be friendly." You know, you either want it from us or you get it somewhere else.
It's very competitively priced as well, and that was something that really struck me.
So, having had the experience at the train shop, we went on to meet Seth Newman, and neither of us had actually met Seth Newman previously. Seth Newman is a long-term listener to the show. Shout-outs to Seth. We were a little bit late, unfortunately. We took a wrong turn, nearly ended up in Santa Cruz, and finally swerved back. In fact, it was a somewhat amusing time through this visit where we made another wrong turn, and Matt Goodman pulled kind of, I don't know, like a 1970s San Francisco-style cop show, pulled through a, I guess, 1970s-style hotel, and the car kind of lurched one direction. I managed to hit my head on the side of the car, and we continued on our way. So I don't know whether he was channeling Steve from Chicago through that experience, but I do kind of get the sense that, yeah, we could have been in a San Francisco cop drama at that point. So we went and had the lunch with Seth Newman. It was an amazing opportunity, actually, to chat to... Seth has been both the chair or the leader of the Layout Design Special Interest Group, and I think he's also been the chair or the leader of the Operation Special Interest Group. Is that right, Clark?
I think so, but I don't know all the things he's done because he's done so many. So I know he's involved in a lot of things.
Matt and I passed the initial sniff test with Seth, and we were promptly invited back to Seth's layout. But an interesting point associated with the lunch with Seth, I mean, we talked about a wide variety of kind of model rail-related interests, but I did ask Seth if he thought that DCC was eliminating a certain group of potential newcomers to the model railroading hobby, just the complexity and, to a lesser extent, the cost associated with DCC, in particular when you have things like Ethernet, which are relatively ubiquitous. And obviously, you know, I have a personal interest associated with the propagation of Ethernet. I don't really have a personal interest. I just like to see it happen. But it struck me that there are certain questions that you just can't ask people because obviously Seth has invested a great degree of time and money and energy. In fact, he has a group that meets every Friday at lunchtime, including a fellow who I believe has done some of the programming for NCE for their controllers. But it struck me that for folks who are hard-coded, hard-embedded into DCC, it probably isn't even a speculative question associated with the difficulty of DCC. So the funny thing from that is the drive to Seth's place, I mentioned to Matt that I thought this was a question that really couldn't be answered by someone who had spent a long period of time invested in DCC. And Matt made the point that he heard a completely different question, which also raised the somewhat amusing topic of, when I ask questions in Model Rail Radio, are they ever answered? But that is a topic for another show. So we ended up at Seth's layout, and the thing that struck me about Seth's layout was that it was exactly as I imagined it would be. I mean, talking to Seth, you got a sense that he was pretty well operations and layout design oriented, and his layout was very much in that light. It is a relatively modern, I think it's 1990s Union Pacific layout. A large yard at the front, which then leads to, well, two industries, but really one big industry, which is really half a dozen kind of sub-industries, a car plant, and then a cooling kind of chemical industry at one end. And then just some beautiful meandering. I mean, the large yard initially, I think it's about 18 feet long. And that is modeled on the Milpitas area of the Bay Area. I think it's Milpitas.
On one side is this main yard, and on the opposite side is this very large auto plant. And the auto plant basically drives all the operation on the layout. That is the main consumer of the car's flow, and everything kind of works around that. If I remember correctly, they do three switching shifts into that car plant. So there's always trains going in and out and moving cars into different spots, spotting them in various doors and so forth. And that goes on in a 24-hour cycle three times there's a train out there. So that kind of takes up, that sort of drives the rest of the layout, because all that, all those cars are then got to be put into the yard, and then the through trains pick them up, or vice versa. They're dropping off those cars, and then the local goes out and switches the plant.
And then there's a beautiful kind of green area, including an over-under and a team of cyclists, which I didn't actually, there was a funny thing, I was there for, I guess we were there for probably about an hour and a half, 2 hours, but I only saw some of this through the photographs that I'd taken. I did my shaky hand cam footage, and as people have noted previously, I do have quite a large shake in my hand, which I guess ideally lends me to doing N-scale in terms of detail or lack thereof versus kind of form. But anyway, so I took a lot of video footage of Seth's layout, and it was only following looking at some of the stills that I saw things that I'd completely missed, both being there and also through the video footage. Anyway, so then you have a section, so that probably goes on for about another, I don't know, 18 feet around of kind of greenery. There are some brick kilns and various other things. Then you come around to a really nice passenger area, actually. The thing leading up to going and seeing Seth's layout, and you've got to appreciate I'm on Seth's layout work group mailing list. I don't anticipate through my day job that I'll have much time to actually attend his Monday night sessions, but Seth has quite an active Monday night session associated with doing various maintenance and additions to his layout, which is quite well attended, actually. But coming to it, I thought that there may be some passenger crossover. To give some background, I mean, this is an area that I'm actually quite passionate about. I really do like the Bay Area Transit, both in terms of industry and in terms of commuter service. And I anticipated going to Seth's layout that there would actually be more commuter service. I mean, as I've noted last show, there is a train track that goes past my office. And funnily enough, I actually followed it on Google Satellite View. And it ends up at the Cupertino, I guess it's a cement works or something, where there was a recent shooting. I'm not sure if folks nationally or even internationally hear about Bay Area news, but certainly in Vegas we heard about the Cupertino shooting. I think five people were killed. But anyway, that's where the train ends up that goes outside my office window. And there's various, if you go up closer towards San Jose, there are various switching problems. As soon as the industry and passenger service crosses over, Campbell, which I technically am, it's really to the north of where I am, is where the passenger service starts, and there's some beautiful interleaving of industrial track and passenger service. So I do have an interest in the Bay Area. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Union Pacific. So coming to Seth's layout, my anticipation was that it would be slightly more passenger service, but the only real point of passenger service is this, I don't know how big it would be, probably about 2 feet long station, which is perfect. I mean, he's got things like a parking ticket on the cars. The cars are very Bay Area-esque. There's a combination of kind of 80s and 90s cars and a couple of Porsches and these kind of things. So I really did like that homage to the Bay Area Rapid Transit BART series. I would have liked to sort of see maybe a couple more of those, but my anticipation is probably at the yard end at the entryway. There's a possibility of doing a little bit more passenger service. Anyway, round from the passenger service, you know, you'd think I'd be talking about this the most, but there is a... I don't know what it is. It's this is one of the points where I have to actually apologise, because I'm recording this well after even when the show was recorded, and I can't recall what kind of industry it is, aside from the fact that it's sand, lots of sand. And it really is an amazing industry. I mean, this industry won an award at the X-2011, the big Sacramento NMRA show. And I can't, for the life of me, actually recall what it won. But it won an award, and it's one of these amazing structures. I mean, it seems even strange to call it a structure, because it really is a substantial industry, where almost every aspect of the underlying industry is modelled in the structure. And Seth took particular care. I don't think he actually built it himself, but certainly the fellow who built it for him, and probably with Seth's feedback as well, took particular care making sure that almost everything that was on the prototype was actually on the model. And I think he made a comment that someone came through the show, the Sacramento show, and made the point, oh, you know, one aspect associated with this thing has long feeds, belt-driven feeds. You know, there was one aspect of the feed which he'd gotten slightly wrong. And he noted that, yeah, there were very, very minor parts, but in terms of the majority of the stuff that should have been on there was definitely on there. And this is an interesting part of the layout, because operationally I think it had a track or two that led to it. But really it's just coming past. And it is interesting, because as vignette layouts go, I think Seth really has a number of components to some beautiful vignettes. But again, you do get the sense that a majority of what he's doing is primarily associated with operation and layout design. And another interesting component to Seth's layout is the sense that you could add a lot more to it. There are certainly areas of long periods of track that could probably have additional industries or additional components added to it. And it was certainly something I reflected on as I walked around Seth's layout, was the sense that when you design layouts of this size, you want to add things in the future, and you want to allow for those things to be added. And I think certainly Seth was very mindful of this. I mean, even starting at the yard section, you got the sense that there was the potential for half a dozen industries to be put in this kind of 18-foot yard area, with the view that you may be, you know, chopping some of the back sections of the yard to make it more interesting. But yes, this layout was phenomenal. It was phenomenal. Just one of the things I found walking around Ted Stevens' layout, which was the next layout we went to, is when Ted gave me the introduction to it last time I visited it, probably about 9 months ago now, I was very much being kind of led around by Ted. And the beauty at Seth's layout and Ted's subsequently was that Matt Goodman was the new kid in town, so to speak. So Matt was very much being led around by the layout owner, with the view that I could do what I really enjoy doing, which is just spending time in kind of abstract points, analysing track planning, a wide variety of things. Anyway, so we ended up at Ted Stevens' layout, and people will remember that I've eulogised Ted Stevens' layout on multiple occasions on previous podcasts, primarily because, very similar to Seth Newman's layout, Ted Stevens' layout is very much about the psychology of the man behind the layout as well. And Ted's layout, initially when you get to it, you get the sense that it's just a whole series of different things, and then you start to appreciate that Ted has actually done hand-lay track over the entire layout. So it's a twice-around loop, meaning that there's a kind of over-loop, which then loops around to a lower loop, which can you know, be kind of back mountains on one side and near-facing towns on the other side. So it'll take the train twice around before it gets back to the same piece of track. And there are two kind of major towns currently. My anticipation is probably that TEP will add another town. Current industries are small structure kits. I mean, basically, his love, aside from laying track, is also structure kits. And it's funny, he's planning a town currently that I took a particular liking to. It could have been a variety of factors, but I just caught myself, you know, visually wandering down the streets of the second town that he's planning. And the thing that caught me also was how little I remember. Well, I remembered a lot. I mean, he's got a large kind of yard section that that I know Clark has talked about previously as well, in terms of just switching problems associated with this yard. But the thing that struck me was how much he had actually touched up, that when I had been there like 9 months ago, there were a series of structures that were laid out periodically through the layout, but he's gone back and added more detail in between them. And I think certainly a couple of shows ago I may have mentioned the trash piles, the rotting tires and various vehicles that are kind of strewn over various points of his layout. He has brought those together more coherently by adding more stuff and breaking some of them up into smaller pieces and these kind of things. So what you get with Ted's layout now is a sense that probably half the layout is getting to a point of near perfection done. I mean, everything from the hand laid turnout to the hand laid track, when you spend time focusing on aspects of Ted Stevens' layout, you really get a sense that he has a particular vision. And it's one of these amazing things. There's a drop down duck under that he took particular time in kind of cantilevering, so it will fit in perfectly. It's kind of cantilevered, maybe, I don't know, a fifth down the duck under, so it kind of lifts up at the point that joins in with the track, and it locks perfectly. And he spent, you know, tens if not hundreds of hours working on this layout to just an amazing level of detail. The other thing that strikes me about Ted Stevens' layout was I was looking at the bench work, and I asked him, because it looked to me like Cephas, and I asked him if it was in fact Cephas. And if you remember maybe a few shows back, I mentioned the Cephas product. Because what you do is you go on the site and you find what kind of benchwork you're going to do, and basically it's sectional benchwork that you order in kind of flat pack, almost a IKEA style, and it comes to you and then you put it all together. And he said that he put his entire benchwork together, and this is probably 50 feet of track around, plus, I don't know, its widest probably 3 feet, at its thinnest probably 2 feet. So it's a serious amount of benchwork that he put together over a 2-day period. And it's all Cephas. And the quality of the wood was good. Everything seemed to tick all the right boxes. You do pay a margin more for it, but in conversation, Matt Goodman is a purist. He believes very strongly that what you need is real wood and a real saw and, you know, real drilling and all this kind of stuff. I'm sympathetic to that, but Ted made the point that has always concerned me. This is a wasteless system. You get the stuff, you don't have to cut it up. All you really need is a screwdriver drill bit. I think I would probably affix it also with glue, but that's probably my own particular proclivities as opposed to Ted's. But it just all fitted together. The wood quality was very good. No splinters. Everything was drilled to perfection. So I could certainly, from my experience of seeing it on Ted Stevens' layout, recommend the Cephas product, and I will certainly be using it going into the future. Unfortunately, the space that I'm currently in, and please remember that I'm recording this time out of sequence, I'm not recording this during the show, but the space that I'm in, you'll be lucky to get a kind of 2-foot section of track anywhere. So not applicable currently, but certainly something that I'm thinking about in the future. And also the thing that strikes me is it's very useful for doing sectional elements. So you'd buy, you know, maybe a couple of sections of this Cephas stuff with the view that when you had a larger layout space, you would just kind of screw in more sections of the Cephas, and slowly you build yourself a layout out of that. So big tick in the boxes with regards to Cephas, and wonderful seeing Ted Stevens again. I mean, Ted is just one of these salt-of-the-earth characters. He tells a story of people coming in and visiting him in this environment, and his layout is in an office park. He said while we were there that he had anticipated actually getting more people through the NMRA convention, but people couldn't actually find the layout. it requires a couple of tricks to even get to the office park, and then it requires a couple more tricks to get to Ted Stevens' I don't know what you call it, suite, I guess, in the office park. So it was very funny hearing Ted's kind of dry account of missing out on seeing these people because they couldn't actually find their way to his particular space. But he's very well known in the office park. We got lost getting to his place and just mentioned to someone, you know, do you know where Ted Stevens' suite is? And he's very well known in the office park. People come through continuously. So if there's one thing he does well, it is actually showing his layout to people. But it was wonderful seeing Ted again. And then Matt and I decided to catch a bite to eat. We went to a Thai place and Matt produced his layout plans, and I have to say, I've got to caveat this by saying, in the near future, I anticipate actually having enough space for a layout, so a lot of what I'm saying is not necessarily in bitterness, but is in, I don't know, I have a keen sense about what space means, and my concern with regards to space is it is a luxury. You do not want to be perverting or filling unnecessarily space, and I think the thing that really concerned me with Matt's layout, almost to the point of obsession, was a tight helix, a 30-inch radius helix area. And I guess my concern with that was that it was a complete misuse of space, but also I anticipated that the helix was just slightly too tight for the space availability. Now, Matt told a story of running trains and actually testing the 30-inch radius, but I guess my concern with the helix is that you need more in a helix than you would in a flat radius, so potentially 2 inches on either end, if I remember by John Armstrong well enough. Aside from that, it's a very interesting layout. I mean, it's kind of an S-shaped layout with the S kind of looping around and forming a U. So there's a wall section that has to be worked around, but the helix is in the foot of the S, which kind of gouges into the rotating, I don't know what you'd call it, the stem of the S going round. So, I don't know. My sense for the helix was that it was just an abuse of space, but I know Matt is very helix passionate and probably will not be swayed in this light, so I don't want to editorialize too much about the helix, but I wasn't particularly impressed with that. I was impressed with the majority of the layout, however. Aside from the helix, I think it's going to be a very interesting layout. It's a double-deck layout, and I guess my thought initially was make use of a single-deck environment. Particularly, Matt is moving from the shelf layout, which is perfect a lot of things, into this layout. And I guess Matt reassured me that he's going to get the first section or the first level of the layout done to a point where he can at least operate on it. And another one of the things about this layout that really caught me is that it's recreating an experience of Matt's father's looking at this particular railroad that Matt is modelling. So a lot of it has his father's hand in it as well. And that I thought was really, really nice. I mean, there was something nice about firstly hearing the history of the particular road that he's modelling, and also, I don't know, just the element of kind of father-son working together. His father is an architect and had done some amazing track plan drawings, and if you were a visual aesthetic for kind of architectural drawings, it immediately kind of popped out to me what the layout would look like. But like I say, a little dubious about the helix, but everything else was pretty A1 with me. And the funny thing about it was that I don't think he really had an opportunity to chat with Clark and Co. Associated with the layout. But anyway, that was my day with Matt Goodman. Absolute pleasure. Wonderful meeting Seth Newman. And my hope is that I won't be a shut-in, although anticipation with work currently is that I'll be a shut-in for the next few months. But it will be really great to have the opportunity to see a wide variety of folks' layouts in this area. Unfortunately, I'm going to be disappointing initially, and that's one of the things that, you know, when you move to a place that has such a high quality of layouts, I just don't feel worthy. It's really quite a strange thing. I mean, I'm known as a talker in the hobby. I'm known as a reclusive voice in the hobby. But actually now to be getting out and seeing layouts and these kind of things, I'm going to have to get my chops up. I've got a lot of work to do here. I've got a lot of thinking about a lot of work to do. But yeah, I'm going to start small. N is my scale. And it was funny, actually, there was a time I was sitting down with Matt and with Ted Stevens, and Ted started producing all these large aluminum jig fast tracks saying to me, oh, you can borrow these, you can borrow these. I made the point to him a couple of times, actually, I'll model in N. N, N's my scale. And Ted's a little hard of hearing, so he kept on saying, oh, yeah, you can borrow this, you can borrow this. And Matt, who'd heard me by this point, was trying to encourage Ted that I probably wouldn't be borrowing his HO-related stuff. Just not applicable, unfortunately.
I wanted to get on the one and only Jimmy Simmons. Hello, Jimmy.
Hey, what's going on, Tom? Guys, Clark.
I wanted to talk a little bit about laser ownership, because this is something that a number of folk have talked about, and I think we had on Jeff Adam from Motrak last show, and he made the point that he doesn't actually own a laser, that he creates his CAD drawings and then farms them out to other folks who do own lasers. For the stuff that you're doing, I understand that you're doing a vast quantity of stuff, much more than just model rail, but obviously you want to fit model rail into your laser work. Give some feedback associated with the cost and the setup. Do you think it'll eventually come down in cost to the point where it will be just like an expensive laser printer or something like that, or do you think there'll always be a margin of cost? And
well, I think you can get them fairly cheap now on the used market, probably in the $3,000 to $5,000 range. But you know, the problem there is you don't know what you're getting in maintenance. The maintenance, if you're going to, you know, do it as a business, you know, I myself, I was in the corporate world for years and years and years, and 2 years ago it all fell under, and so you had to reinvent yourself. So to me, you know, a hobby-based business sounded wonderful. I mean, it doesn't it? I mean, it just has a wonderful ring to it. But the problem is you know how to make $1 million really quick in a hobby business? Start with two or three. But I knew I had an audience. I knew I had a talent that I could offer to folks that I could do something with. You know, with me, if I can do some good as well as make some money at it, you know, it to me, it's better than making money doing something deceitful. So the laser, I knew by getting a laser that I could put out kits, I could cut for other folks, I could do a lot of things with it. So I could start the business already having contacts. But to me, to make money and start a business, it's going to be about outside the hobby, cutting for sign shops, cutting for you know, stationary folks, doing awards, you know, you name it. There's a lot of business out there that can be done. But yeah, me and Jeff talk. I may do some stuff cutting for Jeff. You know, but I think if you're going to buy a good machine, you're going to get a good maintenance plan. You know, you're going to have to me, it's a relationship working with the company. I went with Epilog. I did a lot of searching. I did a lot of interviewing and looking at a lot of different products. A couple things I liked is since I had a graphic design background, and that's the other key issue. Anybody can buy a laser, but if you can't manipulate the files and get them on the machine, you might as well not have it, because all the laser is a printer. So if you're not going to use your printer to print out artwork, you're not going to use the laser to do it. So because of my graphics background, I can manipulate anything. It's a new product I just came out with. It's because of dealing with bump textures and 3D graphics and interfacing that with the laser. You know, I'm sure there's some people in the hobby that can do that stuff, but not a lot. So why not use that to my advantage? And so that's, you know, Jeff, yeah, he does some great drawings. He does some stuff. He just doesn't own a laser. I'm sure he will own one day. But you know, you've got an exhaust system, okay, that lets out a lot of smells. And if you're not going to get a filtration system, which can run from anywhere between $1,200 and $5,000, for just a filtration system, then you know you're going to have issues. I think Bernie had some issues in his neighborhood. He had to end up spending a considerable amount of money on a filtration system. My setup is a little different, and I haven't had that issue, so I'm okay right now. But I'm also in a rental. It's a rental home, so I can't do a lot of permanent installations of things. You know, these lasers, there's a lot of home business with these lasers. They're made to work in the home, these certain size ones. And they're very, like I said, it's like a printer. The other aspect is Epilog, the company was created by a few engineers. So these guys, they modulate everything. So every laser they make, if they do an upgrade, it's just a plug and play to upgrade it, and they keep them very inexpensive to swap out these parts. So you can always stay on the cutting edge. You know, you don't have to worry about selling your laser off and buying a new one because you can keep it up to date. And so far, their maintenance plan has been wonderful. So you got to look at all those aspects in owning one.
I mean, you've talked about the potential to get folks such as Jeff from Motrac doing their kits. But in terms of your own kit planning, what do you think you'll be coming out with? You've mentioned, obviously, a passion for ON30. And the interesting thing about ON30 or O-scale kits in general also apply to wargamers as well. And this is something that I've seen less so. There are a lot of wargamers kits that say, oh, and actually you could also, you know, use this on a O-scale. And they refer to it internally within the wargaming kit community as O-scale kits. But I don't see the same happening with regards to model rail, that they actually see the wargaming community as being a potential as well. But do you think your first kits will be in O-scale for ON30, or are you going to, I mean, obviously HO is the biggest and the most used. I guess either you create a niche or you go for, like, you know, standard kits that everyone's going to use in order to create an instant market. What's your own thinking?
Well, firstly, I love the war game market, the military market. So I've already been looking at designs that can either go into both sides and work, you know, intermingling it, or doing completely separate designs. So I you know, most folks who own a laser have basically said to me, I wish I never bought it. and you know what? To me, their way of thinking is not like mine. I don't mind a small job. I have a bunch of local guys in the area in my own NMRA group who's been sending me work, one little job here, one little there. My business is based on that kind of business, so it's not a pain in the butt to me. But so most other guys who own lasers, they don't want to deal with these little things. So one, I believe I'm opening a market up for myself there. Two, if I want to own more than one laser, I need to. So I need to keep this thing running. So if it means going into the wargaming market, I don't want to be a commercial, you know, guy. I want to make sure that what I'm doing, it's custom. It's like with what I'm doing for this laser cut brick that I have. To me, it's revolutionary. It's 3D laser cut brick in wood. It's painted. People think it looks like plaster. And it's easy to work with, I want to stay on the cutting edge. I'm going to put out brand new designs. Take your windows and doors, laser cut windows and doors. I won't use them in my own kits. If it comes with a manufacturer, comes with them, I replace them with something from Titchy or something else, because most of them are boring. They're, you know, it's a few lines drawn. Well, my brick, it's not vector cut. It's not CAD drawn. These are come from photographs of actual brick walls. So I want to try to create maybe a window product. So my point is, if I can create these little niche products and then come up with a kit that combines all these revolutionary products, it's sort of where I want to go with it. But we'll see. It just depends upon how busy I get. I've been unemployed for the last couple of years. So it's called reinventing yourself and putting it all on the line and going for it. So, we'll see what happens, but, you know, I'm having fun, and my wife is my partner, and she's right next to me, backing me, you can't do it without a good partner like that, so.
Very good, very good. It is an interesting thing. My wife, too, as I mentioned last show, went through this kind of career reinvention associated with the collapse of the building industry. When you have these points of pause, and I've actually also had these points of pause in my career when I've been employed as well. Like, there's something really wrong with what I'm doing currently. I guess it's ended me up in the Bay Area in the most recent iteration. But the ability to have a business outside the hobby, but also move into the hobby-related business, I think is a very interesting model. And certainly, I'd like to get you back on periodically to get updates.
Absolutely.
Since you were last on, our favorite combined topic of... near and far post-apocalyptic modeling. In terms of this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, in large part because I'm missing the... I mean, you used to live in Vegas as well. You know the kind of post-apocalyptic feel of industrial Vegas just off the strip, these kind of things. Yeah. In terms of the potential of creating some of these things with laser, I think this is something that I've been thinking about a lot recently, particularly... Because I think there are certain... I mean, moving to the Bay Area, it's completely different visually than the Las Vegas aesthetic. But I really do miss aspects of the Las Vegas aesthetic. You were talking about your brickwork. You've taken this from photographs, and I'm assuming I don't want to necessarily get into the underlying technology. But you probably have the ability with your photo matching on the brickwork to also take photographs that people have and do quite a high level of detail. I guess what you're describing currently is that you want, there needs to be an intermediary like what Jeff does at Motrac associated with actually making those things into kits. But do you think with the software eventually we'll get to the point where, and I mean 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago now, I was working with a company where they would literally take video footage driving past a building, put it into the software, it would do post-processing, and then you would get a CAD image of the building. I don't know where this technology's gone in the past decade, but my assumption is that it's getting better and better. And the stuff that you're talking about almost will get to the point where, you know, people will have photographs and video footage. I mean, obviously, ideally, you have more than one image in order to get some kind of stereo perspective of what the thing looks like. But do you see this kind of software coming out where you have CAD software where you can put it over photographs so people will actually eventually be sending you a few photographs of a building and you'll just get the texture right and these kind of things, and then the software will do the rest? Do you see that coming up?
I can do that manually right now. It'd be nice if there was some kind of software that sort of put it together for you. I don't know if there's something out there or not. I truthfully haven't looked. It's something that, you know, right now, you know, with the way the laser can 3D engrave, you can get a lot of depth and detail. So, yes, yeah, we can take... in fact, I use a lot of the same techniques and textures that you see in the video gaming world for making their bump textures. And so when I have a lot of access to files of bunkers and broken down bunkers and chipped concrete, and you can get fairly close duplication on the laser with it. And the other thing with the building, I've already got sample pieces where when I take the brick sheets, all I have to do is put a vector drawing over that, after the sheet's engraved, you cut out your building, you get a beautiful brick building, exactly how you need it. So, then all you do is 45 degree in the angles, the corners, and all the corners go together perfectly. So, yeah, we can do a lot with post-apocalyptic. We can do a lot with anything, you know. The bottom line is because of the graphics and what the laser can do, putting them together has been a lot of fun. So yeah, we can do a lot of those things. Well, what's really nice is I use software on my iPad. It's called Multimeasure 2.0, and what it does is you take a photograph of a building, you bring it into your iPad, just a regular photo, and you know that that the door frame is 7 feet tall. So you go into the picture and you say from here to here is 7 feet. And then whatever line you draw on that building, it gives you the exact measurements. So you can get exact measurements to any building as long as you have one reference point. So things like that, so we can get pretty close for drawings-wise, vector-wise, without doing a lot of math.
Yeah, and in terms of awards as well, you're going to be cutting the Berties, and I need to apologize for not getting back to you so quickly. My recent period has been pretty hectic in and of itself. It's not going to slow down for a couple of weeks. After that slows down, I'll certainly get you the Berties.
Well, what I can do, Tom, is I have access to, since I'm a dealer for a lot of these award companies, I get them at cost. So what I can do is I can send you a link to some different awards if you want to go that route, and sort of look to see what they are, and just, you know, we can see what the cost is on them, and then, you know, obviously the cutting won't cost you anything. The awards I just did for the structure show, like I said, everyone keeps coming by. They came out gorgeous. So the product's not that expensive when you look at it. Like these awards that I did for the show, I think they cost me $16 a piece it's like 6 inch by 5 inch or something chunk of inch and a half thick piece of acrylic. Okay, so it, you know, it's not a, but that engraved would sell for like $69. So it's kind of like comparison savings, sort of what you can look at.
So that's something I hadn't even considered. We've talked a bit in the past, and I know you have on your show as well, associated with 3D printing. And what you're actually doing there is effectively like 3D printing. You're using the laser to cut into the material to get a 3D surface.
Yes.
And quite a level of detail. So that's really fascinating. Okay. So the potential is to have both wood and acrylic component kits that actually have a phenomenal level of detail, both with regards to the 3D printing effect that you're getting on the wood to texture it, but also the difficult parts, which previously, I guess, had been done in metal, and kind of cast metal, you can now do with acrylic as well. I mean, no doubt you need, you know, this is why you need good air filtration.
The point is you can use a lot of these laser cut 3D images as a master for a mold, and then just produce them in resin or whatever. So, I'm looking at a lot of that as well.
Yeah, it sounds like the sky's the limit, but I do like your idea of taking bit jobs, basically, to pay the bills, so to speak, and then doing what else you can do in the hobby. And yeah, I'm the potential of the wards is just completely blown, because I was thinking very much simple cut wood.
And that can be the same. Cheap wood, a buck piece of wood, and cut it into something. You know, that we can do that as well. In fact, I made some signs for my booth. They look like they could be nice little awards. So I'll send you a picture of one so you can see, and that way you can put it in award mode instead of sign mode.
Very much so. Very much so. Brian, welcome on the call.
Thanks a lot. It's been interesting. Jimmy, those brick sheets, are they 24 inches long, each sheet?
I have them in, 24 inch by 4 inch and also 12 inch by 4 inch.
Oh, okay. Great. That was it.
We can do any size. The other thing that's neat is if you want it, say someone was asking me, I need an 18 inch tall brick wall. Well, yeah, we just can turn the graphic around and print it the opposite way. And now you have 24 tall by 4 wide versus the opposite way. I also have had luck engraving it into chipboard, cardboard. It looks exactly the same. It's amazing. And I've also engraved in hardened plaster and have gotten the exact look of the brick in plaster like it was hand-carved. So there's sky, like when you said the sky's the limit, it's the truth. So if people have custom work they want to get done, there's a lot we can do and a lot of things we can create. And that, to me, is the exciting side of it. I think we can take the hobby in another direction that 3D printing and everything else has already started.
Very cool, very cool. Matt, do you want to get on the call?
Yeah, hey Jimmy, I'm Matt.
Hey Matt.
Yeah, I was just looking at your site and at the image of these bricks, and first of all, the detail is amazing. But I'm curious, so it looks like to me for the image is the unfinished basswood that's been cut but not finished, and the right side of the image is post-finish. Is that what that's displaying?
Yep.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that the right side wasn't the real brick wall.
That's the finished wall. Yeah, my painted version of it, right?
Right. So my curious is what kind of finish to use for wood to get this brass look, the brick look? Is it simply just using a brick color paint and then washing a mortar into the lines, or?
Absolutely. I've done it where I've spray painted the board. I've done it where my favorite is to use a brick-colored powder, and I use an alcohol wash and wash it in, and then I paint. I take different color rust, like I use like a light rust and a dark rust and a black powder, and I put it on with water and just paint individual bricks and then use a stiff brush to blend it all together. Then a little wet water on the bricks, not a lot. I just use a brush to apply a little bit, and then I drip in. I use a watered down paint, and I just touch it in, and it sucks all through the mortar lines and dries. And it's very easy to do. You know, wood, it's not scary like plaster, and it's not scary like resin that some people, you know, that they have that fear. They don't go near that stuff. So at first, I didn't think wood was really going to work, but the experiments just kept taking off, and it holds up well, and the lines are nice and deep, so it's very easy to paint and work with. So I think any technique would work.
you mentioned several different materials that you use. Is there one that you find that, that works better, if plaster versus acrylic versus basswood? Or
It'll be basswood. To me, that works the best. If someone wanted something done on plaster as a master, it takes a long time to cut into the plaster, so it'd be kind of expensive. You know, to me, the chipboard looks great. It cuts at the same speed and time as the basswood, but it's very flimsy. You know, so it would have to be for a very special application. Maybe, you know, we can do different parquet floors and different tile type, you know, patterned floors and things, and maybe it'll work for that better. Than we can also do on thinner wood. I just found that the eighth inch was really easy to work with. It was a common size, and it just, as a product to sell, to me, it was better quality. But we can do it on lesser sizes if needed. But, you know, it's just interesting stuff. I come up with new stuff every day, so it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I was kind of intrigued by your comment also about using these for masters. I two years ago, I bought a plaster kit from C.C. Crow, and he's, you know, he does his own hand carvings, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful work. And but one of the things he says on his site is that, you know, please don't use these for your own masters, because he's had trouble with people passing them off for their own product down the road. So have you had any concerns about your work being sublet, for lack of a better term?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, to me, it's a unique product in itself. So if someone's going to copy it, people are going to know. And you can't control if they do that or not, obviously. If someone, you know, I like to work with non-disclosures as well. So if a manufacturer came to me and said, hey, I want you to create a wall, and I don't want this wall out there, I don't want you reusing it, whatever, you know, then we do that. You know, if you came to me and said, hey, here's a photograph of a wall I want to do, but you know what, if you end up wanting to use it as a product, you can do that. Well, obviously your price point would be different than if you said, hey, no, I don't want anyone to ever have this. So I will try to respect that for people. I won't copy other people's stuff. You know, if someone comes to me and says, hey, I want you to make a duplicate of this, you know, I probably know the guy, and I'm probably going to give a quick call and ask him, because, you know, everybody works hard at this stuff. And I think if we all respect each other's stuff, it just, you know, becomes a better place. But like I said, I can't control what people do, so I'm not really concerned about it. I just we'll keep coming up with new products that will innovate and stay ahead of the game, I guess. I can change my brick wall tomorrow to something completely different. It looks just as good. You know what I mean? It's the sky's the limit when it comes to, you know, it's what's out there. I mean, there's so many types of brick out there. I know you asked Jeff. You know, Jeff does larger rock walls and stuff. He really doesn't have brick because it's a pain in the butt to hand carve, you know. So, you know, if Jeff wants me to carve him some plaster of custom stuff that he's only going to use as his own mold so he doesn't have to do that, then great. Well, we can do that. So, like I said, it's respect everybody and, you know, keep it real, I guess, is my always way of doing things.
So, Jimmy, moving from the laser, associate, you mentioned that you're in a rented place. Are you considering building maybe a shelf layout or something like that in the near future? Are you going to be exploring ON30 in this kind of area? Because we started the call with Terry Terrence, who's dedicated to Rayalo Scaler, and we talked a little bit about the potential of doing shelf layouts in O-Scale, and I think ON30 is the scale to do that in O initially. Is that what you're planning? Are you planning on building a layout in the near future?
Actually, I want to, there's an ON30 group, the Dead Rail Society here in San Diego. And basically it's an ON30, modular group based on, I think it's based on FREMO, rules. And, basically there's no powered track. It's all battery operated trains. So it's a Dead Rail Society. And, that's ON30. So I wanted to do a large corner piece for that. So something that I could use myself for like a switching layout, but also have ends that can go off and hook up to this modular group, you know, it's something decent enough size. So as long as it's modular and I can move it around, we're in a large enough house with enough space that, you know, I could easily, I have a spare room upstairs. I could take that if I wanted to right now and put a layout in it. but you know, obviously I'm not going to do that because it's a rental.
Well, I don't think that's exclusive. I mean, this is the interesting thing. I mean, you mentioned that it being a rental. Talking to Ted Stevens is that he uses the Cephas product, and they basically build sections that you can either couple together in full layouts, or what I was thinking of doing, because it's a very uniform format, is using it actually for small sectional layout pieces that I can then put into a larger layout as I acquire a property that I can put that into. But I think the thing that strikes me, when you say a corner section, that gives a lot of quite interesting modeling potential, because you can do, you know, like tiny offspurs and a wide variety of other things in a corner that you can't typically. Well, it gives an interesting form, and particularly for structure kits as well, you can put structures within the corner. What radius track were you considering putting in that corner section?
I haven't gotten that far yet. Because the other thing is I have that South River Model Works Robinson Electric kit that he put out, and it's a more of a modern era. I think I can get away with like the 70s era with that. And there's an HO. See, yes, I've been talking a lot about ON30, and I had a lot of fun with that Tidehacker cabin. But you know what, guys? It really has made me love HO even more. And you know what? I think the challenge of doing other scales is key to any modeler, because you kind of see what you haven't been modeling when you model something else that you may or may not be able to use when you go back. So I always want to do that kind of stuff. But I love HO. I've always been an HO. And this Robinson's Electric is HO. We have a brand new the San Diego Fremo group in HO. They do about the 70s era. And I wanted to do a corner piece with this Robinson's Electric. It's a big building with five other sub-buildings and a deli, and it would be wonderful. I just don't know where I'm going to put a track yet with it. But I have all these grand ideas, but the biggest thing is I've got to get this business running. I've got to make some money. That comes first, and then all these other ideas they're playing. Plus, I'm still building for my dad's layout. I have the Streeter kit still going on right now. I got to finish the scenery on it and get that installed in his layout. I know we wanted to get you out there before you went, but we'd recently torn a whole bunch of stuff out and rearranging some stuff, so...
Believe me, the last couple of, I mean, the period of time that we were supposed to get together, and, you know, my wife will echo this when she gets here, was probably some of the most hectic, although after I left, the tornado blew through as well. So, I mean, the nature of moving in these kind of circumstances, and you know this firsthand, is that, yeah, the last few weeks that you're there, particularly if you're working, you know, full-time plus through that period, and I was doing a show, literally the show ended, I had a day, and then I flew out here.
Tom, in the last 7 years, I went from San Diego to Tampa with business, from Tampa to Vegas on business, and now I basically said there's no business in Vegas. I got to get somewhere else, and went back to San Diego. I know exactly the trials and tribulations of that.
My hope is, and I don't see this happening in the near future, maybe sometime next year. In fact, we need to get back next year because, Bertie, the origin of the Bertie Awards, is in long stay cat accommodation, so we have to go and pick him up and bring him to the Bay Area. So my anticipation is probably maybe February, maybe a little later next year, we'll be back in Vegas and maybe have a little luxury time. And if we can work out when you're going to be in Vegas, we'll organize. It'll all come together. I mean, we've got a time frame and we have a mutual connection with Vegas. So I'm sure and hopefully I'll have a better camera and these kind of things. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing your father's layout. And I think that option in the future, when we're both in Vegas, will certainly be there. Jimmy, it's always a pleasure chatting with you. I think we have a kind of periodicity of maybe 3 months and have you on. And certainly we need to get Scott on. We need to get... we've had Mike Rose on an off show, but it'd be wonderful to have him on an actual show. And Joe Duckworth as well. I mean, extend invitations for them to come on Model Rail Radio. I think we had Dave Frary on the show.
I want to put out my condolences to the Frary family. Dave's his younger son, David, passed away yesterday. He had mesothelioma, and he had battled it for a few years. Dave really went through a lot of struggles back and forth to New York. These last few years, it's been tough for him. It's another one of the reasons why he was off a lot of the last few podcast shows. I just found that out. So yeah, everyone, condolences to David, and we all wish him and his family the best. Unfortunately, David and myself now have something in common where we both lost sons. So it is not something you wish on your worst enemy. So that to David. And yes, Scott wants to come on. He's actually in Timonium this weekend. Definitely we'll get him on at some point. Skype is a lot, we're used to using it, obviously. So I think we'll be able to get that, get him on and some of the others. So,
well, that is very sad news associated with Dave Frary, and certainly, yeah, condolences out to him. Really tragic news.
Anyway, you put the a downer. I mean, Dave would never want that to be a downer on the show either. So, you know, you need to take it from there. He's a strong guy, and they've been expecting this. It's just one of those things that you have to deal with in life. So, but no, like I said, I want to try. Now that my time is slowing down with not having to work a whole separate full time job right now on a structure convention, that I hope to get on the show a little bit more often. So
certainly. Well, yeah. Pass on well wishes and these kind of things to the folks involved. And yeah, when we have Scott on, it may be a very interesting show, because I think there are a number of folks that have a number of questions, and it's the bits that have been missing in the discussions associated with Scott that interest me. In particular, as you're describing currently, how one actually takes the hobby and makes that into a business, because I know that's something that Scott has talked on previously, and I think obviously everyone's stories are different.
He actually gives a clinic on it, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly my point. That, yeah. Always a pleasure to chat with you, Jimmy. Pass on my regards to all in New England, and we'll need to get you back on to potentially do a post-mortem and also talk about what's coming up early in the new year, by the sounds of things.
Sounds good.
I'll talk to you soon, Jimmy. Take care.
Take care, guys.
We are kind of riffing and we are having a positive show, but I did start the show with an email request. But there's the concern, and some of this comes through the Berties, and some of this comes through having on particular manufacturers and these kind of things, that the show becomes an infomercial. And this is something that I thought about, but we actually received an email to this effect. But I think the real trick of the show is getting folks on, like the Hales, for example. You know, these yes. are people who are very well connected with a particular manufacturer, have a wide breadth of knowledge, but can take calls in. And I'm always mindful associated with the infomercial claim. But it's something that you've also had to tread in the hobby, and you're very friendly with a number of manufacturers. But I think this is something that and the feedback that I gave to the particular listener was that I'm aware of this, and we are working on it as a format to always throw in different things. But it is something that's mindful and something that's been noted, that Model Rail Radio will continue in chaos in its format. Wherever possible. I mean, the thing that strikes me about a number of these folk is that just getting them in this multi-call format means that they get asked questions and pushed in a variety of different directions. So hopefully we're addressing that. We have a number of folk on the call who I haven't actually welcomed on, including Bruce Wilson. We have Chris Abbott. We have Gordon. What? It must be like 6 a.m. in Australia, Gordon.
Okay. It's 5:50. I've been awake for 10 minutes getting ready to fly off to Papua New Guinea today.
Gosh, early in the morning, but I understand that you've been doing a little structure kit modelling recently.
What I got recently was just a very simple little wheels kit. It was the main one that I've been working on. Wheels are a UK manufacturer, so it's a 00 scale building. Very simple little coal shed, cast for some bizarre reason in grey for the stone parts of the building and green for what's going to be the slate parts of the building. So no, I don't think any of those colours ended up staying. And very easy to put together. And the coal pieces themselves, I think, as I put in my blog, cast in a black plastic. And all I did was put them together, weathered them up, or painted and weathered them up to look a bit more like a sort of a Cotswold stone was what I was looking for, a honey-coloured stone with a bit of ageing on it, a little bit of coal dust on there, just done with weathering powders, and made the roof slate and weathered that up a bit, look a bit like coal powders. And the one thing that I had a little bit of fun with a sharp knife on was that the the coal bins themselves are basically identically cast pairs of pieces. And it was just bothering me, I'm not sure, after last week's or last fortnight's show of the OCD side of it for my eye when I was looking at it and going this, because it's just a series of upright timbers and it just looked far too repetitive as a pattern, and I don't like repetition in pattern when it's not meant to be there. So cut up a few of those slightly differently just to get variation in the heights, and then basically dabbed a bit of matte black all over that and some coal dust and other bits on it just to... as a bit of a practice, because I haven't really done any weathering on anything before, and I'm quite happy with the outcome.
Well, that's good, Gordon. How you doing?
Good, thanks, Jim.
Yeah, so you just, for what I've seen, I mean, of course, most of what I've seen of your stuff has been on an iPhone, so it's only so big, but, I mean, it looks good.
Thank you.
Looks good to my eye. But, and so you just were using some flat black and a little bit of weathering powder. You're holding it in place with anything or just putting the weathering powder on?
Yeah, just straight. The main paints I've just been using Tamiya acrylics for the primary color. So I just was doing a base coat of the lighter color and then just doing some dry brushing or very light application for the darker colors sitting on top of it. And then the weathering powders was a combination of I got some Tamiya weathering powders, which are sort of more the earthy ones. And then I'd bought some soft pastels recently just to get the coal dust. I was using the dark pastel for coal dust, and I haven't done anything to fix it. I mean, I really need to hit the whole lot with some form of fixative spray, so every time I pick it up I don't spread everything everywhere, but that's the one step I haven't done yet.
When you put the weathering on via some kind of dust, if the building is set in place or the rail car isn't expected to be handled too much, is there a reason to put fixative on it?
Well, one of the drawbacks with using fixative is that it has a tendency to negate everything you did with the powders, so you have to be careful. And no, if you're not going to handle it, there isn't really any reason to use a fixative. You know, if you want to build up layers of things, there may be a reason to. In my experience and what other people have said is that when you try to use like dull coat or something like that, unless you're very careful, and it's hard to be careful with a rattle can, you'll nuke everything you did and really almost negate a lot of the work that you did, because a lot of stuff that you want to do with a powder is pretty subtle. You don't want, you know, if you want over the top weathering, you're going to be using paint or something. If I really want over the top weathering with powders, I normally mix it with a liquid and then kind of apply it like a paint as opposed to a powder. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that does. We've talked about that in the past, and yeah, the powders that I put on rail cars especially seem to be pretty well fixed. Of course, I'm not picking them up and putting them down all the time, but it makes sense to me. I've never had luck with dull coat out of a rattle can. It seems to splatter too much. So maybe I'm doing something wrong there. But
I don't think you are. I think it just, I mean, it does that. Either that or you have to be. A lot of times what I find is that I can't get the stuff coming out of the can. And by the time you do get it out coming out of the can, you're kind of irritated and you put it on too heavy. Because you're like, what? Why isn't this stuff working?
That's been my experience.
Yeah. I have only read about this a little bit, Gordon, and I don't know if you have them out there. Have you ever seen or used MIG powders? MIG?
I've like, seen them in action from other people on forums and the internet, but I haven't actually seen the MIG powders in any of our stores here.
There is a store here that carries them, because he not only does he do HO scale trains, but he also does armor, a lot of armor models and stuff. And he carries they're a little pricey, but they actually come with a fixative. Well, they don't come with a fixative. You can buy a fixative specifically designed to make these things stick. But the other thing about them is they're a lot of people use them. I don't know what you've seen, Gordon, but they've used them to actually create texture in the weathering that they're doing.
Yeah, the ones that I've seen where you're using some form of fixing, and going back, I think also to Matt's point too, I think unless you had some form of pressure controllable airbrush, or you could actually sort of spray your fixative within some container that would then hopefully settle on them, on the building structure or vehicle that you're doing, I certainly wouldn't be pointing an aerosol can Certainly my building, because it'll blow the powders that I've got sitting on there are really on there quite light. But I have seen that one where mixing those weathering powders with some light varnish, or probably wouldn't be surprised if it's your old future floor wax coming out again, Jim, to get that, especially if you want to get a slightly wet look, because a lot of those powders are going to be affected by the medium they're sitting in. So you could potentially use it to get like a nice wet mud look or something or other else.
Right. Believe it or not, you can. I've used several things for the roofs of my boxcar where I want to have kind of a gritty red rust. I mix the weathering powder with either water, saliva actually works pretty good, or alcohol. Depends on what, you know, depends on what you want to do. Or I actually got a weird effect using future floor wax on the side of that boxcar, the one and only boxcar I've really super detailed. I got a weird effect, and I think it has to do with the future floor wax. I tried putting on a wash using it, and then I painted over it with rust, I think. I'd have to look at the side of a car, and it actually cracked. And the underlying paint cracked like paint does, and it's actually O scale size cracks. It's not, they're, you know, very fine little fractures in the paint, which, you know, you'd think they would be out of scale. But the only thing I can think of how I accomplished it was because the future floor wax is underneath, and because that's a smooth surface, trying to put paint on it, it shrank in an odd way. If that makes sense.
Oh, so the paint itself shrank, not so much that the floor wax underneath it shifted.
Right. The floor wax underneath was fine, but the paint, instead of drying correctly on the future floor wax, it kind of shrank and then made this interesting crackle effect.
Some of that then on your, I've just temporarily forgotten the name of the station that you're going to build. Jim, the...
Cresco?
Cresco. So you could try doing that, get some of the older paint. It'd be an interesting effect.
Believe it or not, that building is freshly painted. That thing
doesn't
have to be
for you, though.
It does, because I'm modeling now.
Ah, true.
So I'm modeling as it is now, which is convenient because the plans that I have are of the structure as it is now. The problem is I only have good pictures of it now. I don't have pictures of it when it was not in such good shape. I kind of want to have it as it is, you know, at least within the last 3 years. So I have no problem painting it pretty well, you know, painting it nicely, you know, instead of killing it with weathering. But that would be an interesting idea if you wanted to get a crackling paint effect, and it would probably work better if I was making the building out of plastic as opposed to wood, because I don't think the future would have the same effect if you're using it on wood.
No, there'll be a bit more holding power or texture underneath it that the paint's likely to less mess around, I'd presume.
That, or you'd have to put on too thick of a coat, because the future is going to soak into the wood. Most of the woods we use, it's going to soak into it. So that's my story. I'm sticking to it because I haven't tried it yet.
Well, I must say, I was quite impressed. I mean, all the pieces that I said, it's a very simple building that I did, and now I'm working on I've been sort of gathering little bits of plastic kits, mostly Daypol kits, and I said this Wills kit, and the other one I've put together, but I'm not even going to bother taking photos. And if anybody is listening, don't waste your time on a lot of the Hornby trackside buildings. Because basically I took it out of the box the other day to put one together that I'd got a couple of months back, and had spent a relatively decent amount on it, and discovered that basically it was four plastic walls and a bunch of stickers. So all the material that's put on it to give you the textures is just basically transfer applied vinyl stickers that you just stick on. And here in Brisbane, as soon as you apply something, the first thing it does is starts to peel because of the humidity. And as we start to go into the latter part of spring, the humidity here is a bit of a challenge that we'll have to work through. And after the last show, so this will be the next one, hopefully at some time soon I can start to put up, I picked up, speaking to Jeff from Motrac Models, and I've ordered his little, the maintenance of way shed, MOW shed. I'll be waiting a couple of weeks for that to turn up. That'll be the postal system that's slowing it down, I should say. And that's the one I'm looking forward to. So I've been practicing on things like wheels kits and other cheaper bits to try to get that, the painting technique, weathering technique and construction, so I can start to use it on a real item.
Now, you're modeling, sorry, I can't remember, but you're modeling Australian prototypes or American?
UK. And I'm looking, if this one, if necessary, I've got a little box, I think like most of us, a little box of a different scale. So I've got some HO US outline scale floating around the place that I'll, if necessary, make a little diorama of, just so I could build this little building because it looked rather nice. Mm-hmm. But yeah, most of my stuff at the moment is UK 00, or this might even just fit as a little sort of side piece on there. Be an interesting little shot. My next, as Clark was saying before, and I constantly get this from my wife, is just getting a bit of track down, make sure you've got something going, start to build a layout. But in the back of my mind and sitting in a notebook is the big one. Not a huge basement empire, but I've got the next plan down for what will be a HO scale layout for the phosphate mines. Or the phosphate line on Christmas Island. That'll all be HO with some interesting buildings.
Interesting. Very different anyway.
It is different. It's one of those ones that there's not going to be a lot of material around that I can find. I think I've mentioned it either to the mailing list or on the podcast previously. There's one decent book, Phosphate Crabs and Shays, I think, or Shays, Crabs and Phosphate.
Yep.
Because one of the things about Christmas Island that most people know about is the red crab migration that happens twice a year and basically blanketed the island in a large red morass of crustacean-y, well, it wasn't goodness, but it'd get everywhere. It'd get on the rails, get on the roads, get in your houses. And one of the other parts of the crustacean life form as well on the island was these things we call robber crabs, which were basically a large land lobster. These were large enough that I reckon even in 187th I can whack a couple around the place and people will see. But I've finally worked out. At one point, I was rather disappointed because the main line on the island was standard gauge. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid I wasn't going to get any of my narrow gauge ability. But it turns out there's actually three different lines. There was a tramway in the mines. Standard gauge was the main line, which ran for about 15 miles. And then there was a 2-foot gauge in the dock area. So I'll be able to get a bit of narrow gauge modelling in as well.
Excellent.
So I understand you probably have to go soon, Gordon, but I'm planning on getting out to Australia at the end of the year, probably only for a week at most. I will have some luxury time to wander and potentially get in a hobby store. In terms of the past few years in Australian model railroading, what kind of stuff should I look for?
I'm not sure what you're going to find in the hobby store. Most of the hobby stores that I've seen so far are going to have a lot of the overseas materials in there, because there's a couple of good local manufacturers. Eureka Models produce some fantastic Australian outline stuff, and also you've got your Auscision. But I think for the most part they're mail order. And you've got the Outback Models. It's not Outback Models. Or is it Outback Models? Sorry, it's the Kits guys. And again, they tend to be mail order stuff there. So you'll be hard-pressed, I think, to find much Australian in the hobby stores, and certainly none that I've found in the two or three that I frequent here.
So there's one in Adelaide that I've been into previously that does have a relatively good Australian section, which was relatively sparse last time I went in there. And my anticipation, if I get back, is to wander in there, although the difficulty around that time of the year is it's either going to be closed or elbow to elbow, depending on what time I actually get there, which is the difficulty in of planning these kind of trips. But I think as you acknowledge that in the past couple of years at least, there's been a real resurgence in Australian model rail. And I guess my hope is to find a store, or maybe return to the store and see that exactly, and potentially kit, rolling stock, locomotive, and also trees as well. It was funny having Murray on because I spent probably an evening cruising the variety of different eucalypt sellers that exist online as well. But Gordon, I understand your time is limited. It's great that you've been able to stop in, and have fun in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, well, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Gordon.
Jim! Ah, it's a luxury to have a chance to chat with you. I actually have a postal address. I mean, it is my work address, but I have an address that you can send stuff to now. And the one of the bits of feedback, a large portion of the show has been devoted to this experience of going to two layouts with Matt Goodman and just looking around. And the thing that struck me less so about Seth's than about Ted's is just the volume of rolling stock that he had on his layout. And I guess I've reflected that I probably have enough in rolling stock, particularly with your parcel coming, to actually do more than I need to on a shelf layout and even a pretty good size N-scale layout, particularly because my interest in industry and switching and these kind of things. But I'm really looking forward to getting the fabled corn syrup plant. Also, I bought the bottle railroad planning, 2010. I also have your corn syrup plant article to get a sense. The sexual photos on the detritus on the track and these kind of things, I think, reflected in an earlier conversation that we'd had. But really, that's the benefit and also the difficulty of having folks such as yourself on the show. I get so much luxurious talking with you that the actual article is like, yeah, I've heard that, yeah, I've heard that. Oh, that's interesting. It's very nice to actually have your print version as well. And I can see why it inspired a number of folk following that to actually start adding things like corn syrup plants onto their layout. I'd like to welcome on Ted Roy. Folks may remember Ted is the origin of the, I don't want to say infamous, perhaps famous traction show. Let's call it the famous traction show. But one of the things that really interests me is that Ted models traction in N-scale. And he also has a very active YouTube video stream. There's something about Ted's videos where you have to almost suspend disbelief and just believe that it is really N-scale, because certainly the quality of modeling and also, I don't know, just the look and feel is very much HO, even though you have to keep in mind that he is actually modeling N. So first and foremost, I'd like to welcome Ted on.
Oh, I'm glad I was able to come on.
When we first had you on, Ted, it struck me that you were taking something that was already pretty challenging in terms of modeling traction and moving it to N scale. But I understand as well you're also taking non-traction N scale locomotives and actually adding traction to them. Is that correct?
Yes. There isn't anything that will run off of a wire in N scale natively. So pretty much everything you wind up doing is having to isolate your motor leads and rework the car so that it actually runs on the overhead.
So the crossing, I mean, I guess turnouts and crossings had always, I'd always thought that they were particularly extreme in traction. But to see it running as well in N, I mean, your videos, I think, describe a year period where you've actually perfected this. But can you describe some of the learning experiences along the way actually getting this to work? And just to confirm, is this your first N-scale traction layout that you've done, or have you done ones previously?
No, this is the first one. When I originally started in traction, I was doing 1/24th scale, G-scale stuff. But I never got to put anything up with overhead. So, yeah, this has been a complete learning experience for me. I've gone through and read cover to cover all the NCAT documentation that's out there, which is all the N-scale catenary stuff, which you can get at the N-scale traction group on Yahoo. They have all of it. And from there, I just took different ideas and things like that and moved forward with it. I understood the basic concept by doing the research when I was going to do it in 1/24th, and then I wound up just scaling it down. The thing that absolutely amazes me every time I go and start working on stuff like this is, one, my patience isn't as good as it used to be.
You must have had amazing patience initially. You've done periodic videos. I mean, there have been gaps, but you have done periodic videos. And the kind of problems that you were seeing a year ago, I think most humans would have just given up on at that point. I mean, I have a number of questions associated with this, but yeah. Can you describe, let's take the turnouts initially. I think yeah. The turnouts were the first ones that you had, the crossing later. Can you talk about some of the problems associated with just getting that to run?
The first thing I wound up doing is just let's see if we can get the first quarter turn done. And I wound up doing that. And then the next time I was able to take time and sit down and do it, I mazed myself and got a quarter turn and a set of straights done. And then the next time I was down there, I actually was able to get the rest of it done. So there was a learning curve on just hanging the wire and getting it to sort of try to stay over the middle of the track. The turnouts are a whole different animal where, because I had the complete loop already done, I actually had to cut into the good wire, the one that stuff was working, to be able to put these tiny little brass fittings in there that Miniatures by Eric were the first ones I used. Those worked great when I was just setting up two switches. The problem I have, it's my bird, is balancing the wires once that's happening, because you wind up setting it all up. When I cut in the first switch, it was great. Everything was tight. I was able to adjust and work through it. And then I wound up cutting in the second switch, and all of a sudden the first switch was a little loose, so I had to go back and futz with that and then go back and finish cutting in the other switch. The other big problem I've found is that going through the switches, you need to understand where the pole is in placement to the car so you know where you wind up having to tip the, because the frogs have to be angled. They're not perfectly flat. You have to favor your normal route, so you wind up leaning them in one direction or the other. And I've also found doing that that different poles need to be leaned in different ways because of the tension of the springs on the wire. Eric, who I'd wind up having his poles exclusively, gave me a set that had different weights on the springs. And the light one, which I use on my little single truck car, is almost nothing touching the wire. So it keeps in contact. It really just wanders itself around. The other cars, really, you can see in the video the difference in the pressure on the wire. Those really push up into the wire. Those take a whole different geometry, is probably not the right word, but the whole different leveling and balancing on the turnouts to get them to work. And if we take your next question, which was going into working with the crossing, which was my nightmare, everything got out of whack when I started doing that, because now the divergent path for the two switches had to be rebalanced. And that had to rebalance again the same thing that was happening between when I put the two switches in. So it only took me three tries, but, you know, third time was the charm when it came to that.
And the role of speed, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, even bad end track work, you know, it'll move in spurts and starts anyway, in terms of, you know, connecting wheels with locomotives. But when you have overhead connections, and particularly in the wiring section, you can see that there are certain points in the wire which obviously may not have the most ideal contact, but a bit further on, there'll be better contact points. This is visually just looking at the videos. So yeah. The early ones, there's a kind of stop-start element to the speed. And when it picks up speed, you know it has enough momentum at least to clear the wire and have a connection. Yeah. But to operate it at slow speed, can you talk about that transitional speed stuff and how you actually calibrated your layout in that regard too?
It was pure luck, some of it. And I'll be completely honest, the high-speed stuff that I've done on the when I've run it fast, I'm actually afraid to do it at a high speed because if a pole comes off, especially the strong spring poles, it's either going to rip the model off the track or it's going to start pulling down the overhead. So running at high speed isn't really an option. Running at medium speed is the way I'd like to be able to do it, and I like crawling. N-scale's hard to crawl, but I really like crawling because it's the only way you can get down to what you'd consider to be a prototypical speed. Most of the time when I'm running my Brill in the videos, the poor people, when they go into a corner, would flip the car over because they'd all be thrown over to one side. You know, unless everybody had their five-point harnesses on. There's just no possible way in the real world that they'd actually be able to do that. And I think that's more of a test. I think some of the stuff is easier to do with high speed than it is slow speed. Because when you're running at higher speed, one, you can bypass sections where you have dirty wire. One of the things I've done on all of my models is made all the wheels pick up. So both rails are negative. And all, like on the last one I did, my Interurban, all eight wheels pick up. On my ICE car, all eight wheels pick up. And there's a tendency in some of the earlier stuff that I was reading for NCAT, for they would only do one half. So you'd only have to isolate one half of the frame. And I, coming from G-scale, I want the most wheels possible to pick up to carry yourself through. Because the wire is the easy part. It's only one contact that's an easy part to clean. Cleaning the track's a pain. comparatively.
Mm.
So, yeah, when it comes down to the speed portion of it, a lot of it also has to do with the fact I'm using an absolutely miserable Bachmann starter set power pack.
That was my next question, actually, was that now you've taken it to what appears to be relatively comfortable operation at crawl over what appears to be, well, going through the video, I mean, you see the progression that you've made. Is it possible to, is DCC possible with this kind of setup?
Yeah, it is. And there are people who do run DCC on overhead. Most of those people do it in HO. They don't do it in M.
This is my point about it being an extreme. Is doing DCC in N possible?
Yes.
Is that the next step?
No. I don't have the patience for it.
So we've reached the Ted Roy level of patience associated with this.
In fact, do you know the gaps that you have in the videos?
Mm.
That's my frustration level. I've gone back and looked at that at different points in time. Like right now, as soon as I finished shooting the video, the last video I put up, the wire broke. So I've got, and it broke in a really bad place for me because it broke right off at one of the hangers going into one of the switches.
Mm.
So I got to splice all that back together in retention. Good or bad, it's still just a real pain in my butt because I just had it all working and literally it went around three times. I walked away to get the camera. I came back, took the photos, walked away, put away the camera, and it had snapped by the time I got back. And you're only seeing the good parts. you're not seeing the car starting and stopping all the way around, or you're not seeing, you know, the dewirements and everything else. If I put together a blooper reel, it'd be a little more fun. But yeah, you're only seeing the really good parts. You're only seeing the highs. You're not seeing the lows, like the wire snapping as soon as I walked away from it.
I mean, obviously, there's an active Yahoo group, as you've mentioned. Is the next stage, once you have it to a level, and it seems to require a relatively high level of maintenance as well, just to maintain what you have, the next stage is adding scenery around it?
Yes. As I keep telling myself that this is a practice layout. I wanted to learn how to hang overhead wire. I've pretty much done that. I wanted to learn how to cut switches in. I've done that now four times in three different ways of doing it. The next step for me is some of the wire I actually have to put inside of an engine house. I have a car barn I got from American Model Builders, makes a single stall engine house, which is going to go on the straight in line. But I'm going to have to put wire through the house, which is why I've just temporarily tied the wire off on the other side of the layout to keep tension to it. I wound up going to a local train show, and I wound up picking up an old Glorcraft models kit of a covered depot. It actually is a run-through, which I think will be real neat to do for traction, because you don't have to worry about all the venting and everything else that went on the roof to get the smoke out.
Mm.
So I think that would be actually kind of neat to add in. And I got a couple other models that I'm adding in to it. So, yeah, it's a complete work in progress. I've done the entire like module type stuff before. My children love me for when it comes down to doing school projects. It's diorama time.
Mm-hmm.
And it works out very well to be able to do it that way. But yes, the progression is that now that I have the crossing working and I have the long industrial spur done with the freight house and the ice house on that side, everything's movable at the moment. It's still up in the air. The other side has got three spurs. One spur is going to go to a powerhouse, so I have a reason to bring in coal cars and a reason to get a freight motor. And the straight back one will be the car barn, and then the one parallel to the main line will wind up being almost like a maintenance track, a place where I can store a plow or a sweeper or something like that. And I'm going to get a crane for over there, not an overhead, but a nice. They make some really nice cranes on docks now. I keep forgetting who actually does that. An N-scale makes a really nice unit for that. But that stuff's going to go over there. And then when I finally decide to be masochistic and go back into doing more overhead, I'm going to wind up probably putting in a passing siding to the back. There is a progression. I still haven't learned everything I want to learn yet.
Could you describe the size of the layout?
The layout is 2 feet by 4 feet.
It is amazing. The turns must be relatively tight then.
They're all done with flex. All I did was for my turns is I put in 3 inches from each side and then put the 2 points on it and then bent the radius around it. and then eased it a little bit when I go into the tighter parts of the curves. So yeah, it's all FlexTrack and Pico short radius switches, and there's an Atlas crossing in the middle. It's, you know, pseudo sectional track.
It's wonderful to be able to follow on YouTube. It's funny, I thought it was slightly wider than 2 feet, but yeah, looking at it on YouTube, like I say, because the camera is so good, but also the movement and these kind of things, you do lose track of actually how small it is.
Yeah, the camera, literally, I'm just using my iPhone, so it's not as good as it could be, but, you know, bad lighting and everything else hides an awful lot.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the crossing earlier. That was interesting because nobody makes a crossing in N-scale. Everybody goes upscales to do that. In fact, I know some of the people who were, when I posed that question to the Yahoo group, they were telling me, well, I use an O-scale crossing. So I went searching around and I found overhead parts by Proto 87, and they do some really nice stuff for HO.
Hmm.
And I started looking at it and said, that's not much different than the size I'm using now. And they actually had a crossing that matched what I was doing. And I wound up using their switch frogs also. I wound up taking out the ones I had gotten from Eric and putting these in. Not as an instead. Most of it is because I didn't have a way to desolder them cleanly. So I wound up going with fresh frogs that didn't have solder all over them. So that's probably why I went. It's why I went with those instead of the other. But yes, it actually does work. And I have tried a pantograph on it, but it catches on everything. Every little bit of either wire hanging down or wire not directly over the track or switch frog not beveled to pass the pan across. So I think I'm going to stick with poles. A little more tolerant.
Mm. I'm overwhelmed. And I'm really looking forward, actually, to the addition of scenery because it's a town, really, isn't it? It's almost like a small city that you're modeling around it.
Well, the whole concept behind the layout is I'd model the Boston and Worcester, which was the inner urban that ran from Boston, Massachusetts to Worcester, Massachusetts. It was built to railroad standards. It was actually one of the first really nice high-speed lines and everything else that they did in the area. And it's one of two that were true real inner urbans in New England, the other one being the Aroostook up in Maine. But what it is, the whole concept is coming from the back side of the layout in either direction is the rest of the world. So when you come in, this section is supposed to be a small branch maintenance location and small industry. And on top of it, we wind up having the different type of freight that I can bring in and things like that. But it has to come in multiple different directions because of the way the crossing and the two switches are set up. They only feed from one direction. And without having a passing track, what I've thought about doing is for operationally, you have a set of cars that are going to come in on one side going towards Boston, and then they'll come in again on the other side coming from Boston. So you'll have things you can service on your way to Worcester or coming from Worcester because of the way the crossing is set up.
Very interesting.
So literally the original concept of the whole thing was the whole backside of the layout you're not going to see. You're going to go into a tunnel on one side and into a tunnel on the other side.
Well, Ted, it's been an absolute pleasure. Please call back in. Just in terms of extreme modeling, you really need to remind yourself continuously that what you're dealing with here is N scale. And like you say, 2 feet by 4 feet. Hard to imagine, really.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I wanted to welcome on Anders. Hello, Anders.
Hello.
So you've been an active participant recently in the Facebook group, but as this is your first time on Model Rail Radio, could you please introduce yourself and your interests in the model railroading hobby?
Well, my name is Anders Wirtén, and I'm living in Stockholm, Sweden. My interest is, I've just come back to the hobby after about, I guess, 30 or 35 years, not active. I guess I've been an armchair modeler. I think you call it that. Well, last fall, my wife told me that she wanted to swap rooms in our apartment, and I could have a bigger room for my office, and that room meant I could also build a small layout. So I started on New Year's Day this year. So that's, I guess, the background.
That's tantalizingly close to the the answer to the question. You have a small layout space. I'm assuming you're doing it in a shelf layout?
No, it's not really a shelf layout. I read about some person, an American who I guess was in the army, and he did the same thing as I have done. I bought bookshelves, not very high, from IKEA, and I sort of built boxes and turned them upside down, so to speak, and put them on the corners of the bookshelves. And then I connected bookshelves around the room, so to speak, and it's in the form of an F.
Oh, okay. Gosh. What are you modeling? What period, what prototype, if a prototype, or are you doing freelance?
I'm freelancing an American railroad. It's called Isola City Terminal Railroad. It runs from southern Brooklyn to northern Queens, and it's set on 13th of June 1977.
Gosh. Why that date in particular?
Did I say 13th? I meant 11th. 11th June. Very, very important. It wasn't that meant to be that exact, but I had the chance to receive the New York Times front pages from my birthday, which is 4th of June, and my wife's birthday, which is 11th, June 11th. And I thought that was quite a nice thing. I can make small pieces of them, put them on a kiosk, and really make it an actual date. Mm. And the thing is that the 11th had a rather cute story, or maybe I don't know the name of him, the man who murdered Martin Luther King.
Oh.
He escaped prison in Tennessee. And that was on the news on the 11th. So I thought maybe I can celebrate my wife, and I can have a chase on the model railroad.
Yeah, it's an interesting period because you're mentioning that era, and my immediate recollection, I think, I'm not sure when The Son of Sam is. Maybe The Son of Sam is the early 80s. But it is funny that we immediately associate New York City associated with crimes, yeah, and these kind of things. So that is a very fascinating period. In terms of the scale, what scale are you doing it in?
HO.
Okay. And are you getting, there's a lot of specialist rolling stock and commuter service associated with the subways, and I guess even the what are they called? They're not called what are they called? The overstreet railroad, actually associated with New York City. Is that what you're modeling, or are you modeling surface street style railroading?
Yeah, I'm modeling surface streets railroad. It's a fictional railroad. Railroad, and it's supposed to run from the southern shores of Brooklyn. So if I ever get the space, I can add a waterfront part, and it runs to the northern Queens. Mm. And you're supposedly I could have a waterfront scene there as well, connecting to the Bronx or.
Mm. So. Obviously, it's a particular place that has amazing visual aesthetic, even in a small space. And certainly I applaud your choices in that line, because there's so much that one can do with that particular area.
I just love it. What more can you say? I mean, when you get there, you fall in love. That's just it. My favorite movie, for example, is Woody Allen's Manhattan. I mean, the visual aspect of this city is phenomenal. It's wonderful. I love the Lower East Side, yeah, and Brooklyn. Yeah, it's just very interesting architecture, and there's an area. I think it's just between Brooklyn and Queens, and it's called Newtown Creek. I don't know if you know what that is. It's sort of a creek that comes in from, that divides Brooklyn and Queens. And it's all these industrial, it's sort of an industrial waterway. with all these rundown industries. There was a book, actually, I think 2 years ago, that I think it's Princeton University who published it, called Newtown Creek. That book really inspired me.
Anders, I'm really curious about modeling New York City, because certainly one of my favorite previous shows was, I think, the Subterranean Layout Muse, also because of its name. And that talked about modeling subway-style railroads, and that obviously lends itself to modeling dense cities. In terms of actually modeling the area in New York that you're looking to model, where do you get your kits from? Are you having to create it all yourself? What kind of stuff do you actually have to get to do that kind of modeling?
I actually don't expect to build very many models at all. I plan to scratch build most of it. I'm not planning to model exact replicas of houses in Brooklyn or Queens. I'm more interested in getting the feel. So I kind of draw drawings for the houses and then build from that.
It is the kind of thing where you could probably make generic buildings from looking at a series of photographs and kind of hybridizing, because a lot of the buildings are the same in some regard. Are you just going to be using then small, like, fascia structures, or how are you going to get the flavor of New York onto your layout?
I wish I knew. When I'm doing this, I have to do bigger models, bigger houses, I guess. Not necessarily higher all the time, but they have to be... And I actually think that would be something generally that you need bigger houses than you often see on layouts. It's not good to have a house that is so small that it just doesn't seem plausible that they had rail service.
That is also, I mean, the strange thing about the area that you're modelling, and I know this from not necessarily my own experience, although I have travelled through that region on a train, is from friends that have lived in that area, and you do occasionally have a house that looks completely out of place in that area quite comfortably, although there's a lot of sameness, particularly in Brooklyn. I mean, the Brooklyn-style houses are, I think it would be relatively easy to create abstracts of that and kind of do rows. But there are circumstances, particularly when you get to the kind of more densely populated areas of those parts of New York, where you can really throw in an absolutely tiny house that would look in place in Kansas in that environment as well. I mean, there are some curious architectural examples of having, you know, four-story kind of tenement-style housing and then one little house that just looks completely out of place. And I think that's actually the nature of the architecture in that part of New York, is that there's a lot of sameness and then there's very occasional bits of difference in there. But it's interesting that you're modelling in HO, because certainly when you describe it to me, and obviously this is my particular interest in model railroading as well, N strikes me because you do have the option of then doing quite large buildings prototypically. But in HO, yeah, I have seen actually HO city layouts on shelves, and a lot of it is done with shadows, I don't know, almost the sense of the buildings rather than actually modelling the buildings themselves. Still getting a sense of where you are initially. I mean, you've described basically the boxes and the bookshelves, so I get a sense of the layout in that perspective. But do you have all the track laid yet? Are you at that stage? What stage are you at with the layout?
I'm almost finished with laying tracks. I would say 80% finished with the track laying and the electrics and electronics. And I've actually almost finished my first house.
Cool.
As well. Yeah, really. I tried to get it ready for this show, actually, but I didn't manage quite. But I can post on the list, mailing list.
I'm looking at your layout plan, actually, and thank you very much for sending that, because that immediately answers a number of questions. So what mm-hmm. you're describing here is almost like a horseshoe with two areas coming off the horseshoe. So, yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say it's an F shape. It's kind of, an if on its side with, I guess it is, on its side with a little bit of kind of extension from that.
I guess it depends on from where you look upon it.
Yes, I guess so. It's like an if plus. But no, it is. I can see immediately, firstly, how you're going to get the flavour of the buildings in there. But you seem to have some industries on there as well. Can you talk a little bit about your thinking in terms of adding industries?
Yeah, it is absolutely, it's just industries. There are no regular homes or houses. It's just industries. It's because that's what interests me, I guess. Mm-hmm. I just love that kind of architecture and the roughness around industries and American and New York industries just in this area, in this era. I don't know. It just fascinates me.
Andres, it's Clark Cooning in Toronto.
Hello.
When you are modeling this, have you been able to get to New York City before?
Yeah, I've been in New York, yes.
Oh, have you? Okay, yeah. Good. So then you have a very good idea of what's going on then. Because I was going to ask you, how did you do your research for this?
No, it's not like I know New York in and out, inside out. It's just I've been there. I love it. I love the feeling of New York. But I mean, the time period 1977. I mean, going there now, and it's nothing like it was in 1977. In 1977, New York was a rather rough city. Very much rougher than today, even if you went to Manhattan. So I guess I just have to look around, and the internet is a wonderful tool. There's so many people posting so many strange things and wonderful pictures. And I mean, for the warehouse I'm modeling now, I had to do packages, or I don't know what you call them, like boxes with the vegetables and sodas and things like that. And I found this guy who obviously collected old packing material and had photographed every single thing from the 30s and onwards and put it on a website and told people, just take every picture you want. It's free. It's crazy.
I know. It is crazy, and I agree with you. The internet has just made the world so much smaller, and especially for us as hobbyists. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at us. I mean, here we are talking with you, and you're in Stockholm. I'm in Toronto, and Tom is in California. I mean, it's an amazing
it's mind-boggling
technology. It is.
Yeah. The internet for our hobby, I think, has an extremely big importance, especially for persons like me who live far away from where all the things happens, almost, I would say. Because news in 20 years ago, the information that I can get in a day could take years to reach our part of the world. Modeling techniques, every kind of thing. With the forums, all I have to do is just go out there and ask a question, and I'll get an answer.
Yes. And especially, I find that, for me, is when I come to like the DCC, the digital command control stuff, I can get an answer within a very few minutes and fix my problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you don't have to tell me. That is not the favorite part for me. I have problems with the electronic. I had a big problem. If you look at the track, then I have this crossing on the right hand. I have big problems getting that to work. I just couldn't make it work. It shorted all whatever I did. And I don't know, I think it was an interview in Modern Rail Cost, what's it called, the other podcast. And they interviewed this guy,
Duncan McCree. He's been on here as well, yes.
Yeah. is he on?
He's not on currently, but he has been on previously. So yes, he's a friend of both shows.
Okay. And I learned about his product, this frog juicer number 2. I ordered it. Didn't cost anything. I have to install it now next week. I just received it. And if it works, as he claims it does, my problem is solved within minutes.
Mm. It'll solve your problem. Okay.
Great. They work, Anders.
Okay.
It's so blindingly easy, it defies comprehension.
Three things to connect, I think.
Yep.
Yeah, basically you connect the bus to it, and then if you've got a dual hexer or a dual frog, you'll connect it to whatever section you need to do one wire to each, and that'll look after your shorting, and it'll figure out what polarity it has to be, and Bob's your uncle.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely no thought involved. I plugged those into the custom crossing at Mike Rose's, and it is mind-boggling that it just works.
Yeah, and
no thought, no nothing.
Yeah, and initially I thought I would have to have some kind of toggle and some kind of light indication on the control panel. But with this, I don't need that. So it reduces lots of pieces.
Definitely worth the price of admission.
Yeah, I would say.
Of all the things in the DCC that you can buy in that, I agree, Jim, that is. And if you have a module set up and you only have one or two turnouts, instead of just relying on the frog, a frog juicer and all those, and you will never have a problem. They are fantastic.
I hope it will solve my problem, because that's things that I don't like to spend my time doing.
I mean, the thing that's scary about them that both me and Mike, and I'm sure Clark has pointed out, not that this is necessarily an infomercial for Duncan McCree, but is you plug it in and it works. And it's so easy, and you're like, there's got to be something else to this.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be. It can't be this easy. And it is that easy. It really is. If you put it together the right way, and there's almost no way to screw it up. I say that, of course. One wire to the frog, the two wires to the bus. You can even cross those, and it's okay, because it figures it out. And it just works. As long as you put the only thing is you got to read the directions, make sure you have the wires in the right spots. The main thing is you have to make sure that the wire going to the frog is in the correct terminal. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's absolutely mindless.
Returning perhaps to Anders' layout, because the thing that strikes me about your layout is that it's very similar, although it's on a separate coast, to Bill Kaufman's layout associated with San Francisco. And the ability to model, I guess what you're doing here is industries, but also roads and rail around the roads and these kind of things. In terms of the actual industries on the layout, are you looking at prototypical industries? And what kind of industries are actually going to be on the layout?
Well, there will be one called storage house, a freight house. Mm-hmm. It's in the back upper left corner. That's the one that I've almost finished. And in front of that, there will be another freight house with dry goods. And then there will be some freight houses, and there will be in the upper right corner, you'll see with a number 10, that's a grain elevator. Mm. Because in the lower right corner, you got the big industry, which will be a beer industry, a beverage.
What number is that, Andrew?
The number 14 is the beverage, but
okay, on the
track, the track plan. It's not really exactly the way it was built, because I use a German software, and then actually I found it was okay, it was all right, but it didn't really meet up to the preciseness that I wish for. So I quite soon spotted that it wouldn't be exact. So I just I draw a approximate track plan and then finished it directly in sight, so to speak. So it's roughly correct, but it's not exactly correct. And the, actually, the beverage will be bigger and have more space than you see there.
So expanding to the road, basically. It fills up the section to the road, yeah.
Yeah, precisely.
In terms of the location of the turnouts and in terms of the industries, mm-hmm. these are obviously going to be powered turnouts. They're not going to be hand-controlled turnouts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting a sense of the layout basically as you're talking as well. So a lot of the layout will actually, the rail part will be obscured by some of these industries in a number of the places.
Yeah, that's actually what I strive for. Cool. But not only that, the rail, that the locos and the freight cars should be obscured. At the same time, I wanted to leave sort of open space because desolate places. Because in a city, that's quite common. So if you look at the center, it's sort of, there's nothing there.
Exactly. But the thing that interests me is just right at the center, the 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 yeah. structures, there's yeah. some rail traffic going through there which is almost completely visually obscured. So you would need to almost stand in the kind of far corner and look in order to see any of the rail traffic that was going through there. Is that intentional as well?
But I think that the track plan probably needs some kind of explanation, because if you look at number 11, that's not a building, that's a scrapyard.
Ah, okay.
And number 5, that's some kind of oil or chemical receiving point or loading point. So the spur that goes should have gone between 7, 8, and 9.
Yes.
It's not going to be building over there. It's okay. Just at some point I changed something and I just didn't care to change the buildings.
Mm.
I already had it on in place, so it wasn't important for me. Now that I talked to you, this was all I had, so I sent it.
Yeah, no, it's perfect for kind of walking us through your layout. In terms of model rail in Sweden, we have a number of listeners in Sweden, and yeah. it's an area that I've visited briefly through work, mm-hmm. and obviously travelled by train there as well. But in terms of the local model rail community, can you describe that?
Well, no, I don't think I can, because I'm not really part of it, actually. Mm. I tried. And actually, I found it too hard. I gave up. They weren't interested. And, frankly, I don't care then.
We're not alienating listeners here. There may be others like you in Sweden.
No, but I mean, it's fine, because... But there were lots of people who they knew each other. Mm-hmm. And when I came back to the hobby, I didn't know these people,
mm-hmm.
and they were very hard to you know, get to know. They didn't invite me in, so to speak, if I put it like that. When you went to all these meetings and they were never, nobody was ever interested. I got two or three friends who is into the hobby, and it's good enough for me, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then I've befriended lots of people during this last year, through forums and so on, that's great. Now I got a bigger, more friends outside Sweden now than I have inside Sweden, dealing with in model railroad.
So just to still get a sense of the landscape, what you're describing here is not that there are. I mean, are there model rail shows that you could attend, or these kind of things, or is it all club meetings, that kind of stuff?
No, there are model rail shows. I've never been to any model rail show in America, but from what I've heard and read and listened to when you describe them, I would say that they're of a much higher quality, I guess. But I mean, there are some shows that are quite good, but they're not really shows. They're more kind of you go there, you meet people who who are into the hobby, and there are stalls for selling things, more or less that sort of thing. And then there are clubs, and there are some clubs that are really, really good. Lots of Swedish modelers that do exquisite work, really, really. And probably because the ones who's been doing this for long, they're not used to having lots of material. They have to scratch build their things by themselves, traditionally. If you want to model Swedish, that is.
Yeah, I guess that was my question, because certainly in terms of German and even French prototypes, and I have a number of friends online in what I would call Eastern Europe, and even they do a lot of kit bashing and, as you describe, you know, building from scratch associated with their particular areas. But I always got the sense that there was a Swedish like manufacturer. Maybe they're just adding additional stuff, but I don't know anything of that. And
oh yes, there are several, actually, but they do small batches. Mm-hmm. There's one who has gone from doing brass models to now doing plastic models, I guess, in Korea. It's called Jeco, J-E-C-O, and they're very good. The thing is that if you want to model Swedish railways today, you're in a good position, because today there are lots. It's impossible even to buy everything that comes out. So today the climate is very different from what it was 10 or 20 years ago. So today you can really buy almost, not everything, of course. I mean, you can't even buy everything in America. So.
No.
but I mean, it's all there: steam engines, diesel locomotives, electric locomotives, and also there's a Norwegian manufacturer called NMJ. They also do exquisite models, primarily. What's it called? Passenger coaches and some freight cars as well. So they have more or less flooded the markets, actually.
So in terms of your particular modeling interests, and you've mentioned podcasts and forums and these kind of things, what more would you like to hear to assist with the building of your layout?
In the podcasts?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know. I think you're covering it very good, especially if you combine. I mean, there are three major podcasts: so Raycast, Model Rail Radio, and Scotty Mason. Mm-hmm. And you're covering it. I mean, Scotty's main interest is Craftsman structures, and the two of you, the three of you, are actually covering it, I think, very good. Well, I don't know. But yes, there's one thing, and this is very interesting. That is, I guess, why you're having me on now, widening the perspective. I think that would be very nice to hear from others who models, actually, someone who models Swedish railways once you get a Swede on, or a Dane, or a Norwegian, you know.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that's one of the reasons that I wanted to, I mean, particularly when you started corresponding record.
You hoped for that.
It was in the morning. No, I'm not saying that at all. But what I'm saying is that the international, irrespective, I mean, you could be modelling Union Pacific, but the international perspective on the hobby, particularly associated with the access to materials and these kind of things, it's all relatively unique. The thing that interests me about recording Model Rail Radio is actually to get folks in the hobby such as yourself to become part of the discussion. And certainly your area of modelling is one that I have a strong interest in, and I'm really looking forward to actually following your development through mm-hmm. constructing this layout, because it's something that I have, as you do, a keen visual aesthetic sense associated with. And I get the impression, and particularly going back to the late 70s, that finding prototypical photos and these kind of inspirations, although, as you note, they're all they all appear to be available online. Even so, getting the flavor exactly right is clearly going to be a tuning process. So I would welcome you back on future shows. In fact, I'll be sure to record in more Swedish-friendly timeframes, particularly as your availability is noted, so we can get you back on and follow this with the... I'm really interested in seeing how it goes, and please do post photos on the mailing list or the Facebook group as you make progress, because it's a fascinating period, a fascinating place, and you have a unique perspective on it.
Yeah, well, there's one thing you asked me if there was something that was missing, and I think actually there is. It's not your the podcast. It's the main focus. This time period that I'm modeling, the 70s. Seems to be rather either you do old stuff, really old stuff, like Biscayer, or you do steam in the 30s, and often the narrow gauge guys are there, and then there's the transition era, and then there's this modern stuff, but the 70s always seems to disappear.
It is an interesting period. I think what you'll find, and this has been noted, I think, by others that have come on, is that as time progresses, there will be more people modelling the 70s. The things that you've noted associated with birthdays and these kind of things is very true in the hobby. And as people reminisce about the 1930s and the 1950s, this, again, is to do with their birth periods and a wide variety of other factors. And as more of us move into the hobby, I think exactly what you're saying, that the 1970s, there have been a few model railroader articles associated with associated with the 70s in recent years, particularly people that have either modern layouts or 1950s layouts that are interested in more operating interest. They will kind of converge on the 70s as a kind of meeting point. But I think as more of our age demographic get into the hobby, you will see a lot more 1970s modelling. And similarly, there is a small group of 80s modellers, and I know a small group of 60s modellers as well. And I think what you're seeing, the 1950s has an obvious advantage in terms of transition era, in terms of the ability both to run steam locomotives and diesel, but there is an aesthetic quality. But you mentioned the use of film, and this is something else that has not really come up in the show, associated with people actually going back and looking at particular films through the period and the area that they're modelling. And I think of there's a movie called Serpico, which is an early Pacino. So there are all these beautiful movies that are based in the 70s, late 70s, in the area that you're modelling. And I think the exploration of film as well is something that is very interesting when you talk about your particular period, because unlike, I guess, the 1950s, there were certain films that wanted to capture the grit. The 1970s, almost all the films, and I was making a joke earlier about kind of 70s San Francisco cop movies, they're all about the grit of the city. So you're really, the period and the area that you're modelling is going to be captured in film very well.
It's quite funny that we got into this, because Isla City Terminal Railroad, as my railroad is called, it derives from Ed McBain's series 87th Precinct. Isla was his Manhattan. And I'm modeling Calms Point, which is Brooklyn, and Manchester, which is Queens. And my favorite TV series of all times is what's it called, the Cops, Hill Street Blues, which was loosely based on Ed McBain, even though they never admitted that. And that was, it's kind of, it's that aesthetic, I guess, I would like to capture.
I have a number of books of New York City cityscape photos. In fact, it's one of the things associated with various museums, but these are now all available on Amazon as well. And I agree with you that there's going to be a lot of stuff available on the internet associated with these kind of photos. But the high-resolution kind of art book, coffee table-style books, cityscapes, and in particular Brooklyn, Bronx, and Manhattan through this period, there are a lot of fine art photography books as well, which aren't too expensive. I mean, they're kind of $20 to $30 US in price. So, yeah, in addition to this, when you get down to that level of detail, I would certainly recommend using Amazon or something like that to identify these kind of books too, because I have a number. I like shop fronts in that area too. And one in particular I'm thinking of, which is color shop fronts. I think it is the late 70s and early 80s. And just the wide variety of billboards and things that appeared on shop fronts. And similarly, I have black and white, a black and white photograph, which is a large format photography book of New York City images as well. And I think there are a lot of resources. Obviously, the online stuff is good, but it is of a particular resolution. And when you get down to modeling kind of extremes in HO, you may want to look at some of these. They're now fine art books. I mean, basically, they're originally street photo books, and then they became fine art books. But yeah, it's a fascinating period. And as soon as you mention that, immediately, there's, you know, as you say, there are so many kind of euphoric elements to it. I'm really looking forward to seeing how this layout turns out.
Well, let's hope for the best then. I mean, it's been, I haven't done any modeling in 30 or 35 years, and here I am. I'm just finishing up my first model, and it's my first ever scratch build model. So let's hope for the best.
Very good, very good. So, Anders, you've listened to previous shows, obviously. You have the amazing ability, because I think you've captivated a number of participants on the call, and they're still on the call.
Oh, they've fallen asleep.
No, I think they're still there. They're still typing in the chat. In terms of general esoteric questions associated with modelling, you've mentioned that really we are becoming your community in this regard. Do you have any just, like, general questions that you have that you want to throw out?
Regarding my modeling, or?
Well, if you have them in general, but if you're finding specific issues, I mean, you mentioned the frog juicer.
Yeah, I have a specific problem. How do you model dirty windows? I mean, a freight house and an industry in this period didn't have clear windows. How do you simulate that? Anybody? Some technique?
We've got a number of people on the call. Jim, do you want to start with that one? Maybe they have all gone to sleep.
Yeah, seems like.
What was that? Okay, Tom, yes, what?
Dirty window modeling techniques.
Dirty window modeling techniques?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you got a freight house or an industry, say, as I am modeling the 70s, there were no clean windows in this freight house or in this industry. How do you simulate dirty windows?
Paint the back with, say, tan, you know, earth-colored paint. Or spray the back with dull coat. Depends on how dirty you want them. Because at the time, the building that I used, I have one craftsman structure that's relatively complete. And the windows, I painted the back of them with I think... some tan or wicker colored craft store acrylic. And then on the inside.
Washes of acrylic or.
Yeah, water, you know, water based acrylic.
Yeah, and washes.
No, I painted it right on. In this particular case, okay. I painted it right on. Because the problem with water is, particularly on the back of acetate, it's going to want to puddle up. It's going to want to bead, and it won't stay. It won't really cover very well. So that's what I did, as I recall. And then what I did is I took a toothpick, and on the back of some of the windows, I wrote stuff backwards. Mm-hmm. You know, like tic-tac-toe and a couple other things I wrote on a couple of the windows with a toothpick. I don't know. You couldn't do that with an N scale, but... That's what I did. You know, you can try for different effects. It really depends on the level of dirt that you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it would differ. I mean, in some cases, really extremely dirty. And in some cases, I mean, if you got a, for example, this cold storage house, they would be dirty, but they would still be see-through. I mean, it was the light.
Right.
For the people who work there, and so...
Right. So, I mean, see, this I didn't put it on so thick. The thing is with craft store acrylics is they're not going to cover so well that they're going to cover the window in one coat. Mm-hmm. You put on one coat, see if you like it. And the other thing about a craft store acrylic is it's easy to get off, particularly off of acetate. It'll wipe right off. It's, if you don't like the effect, you know, do something else. You know, just wipe it off, try a different color, try a different paint. You know, The other thing is maybe you could put, you could try to use powders, but the powders aren't going to stick very well either. The one benefit about a powder is that it's unlikely that you're going to be able to get your fingers inside the building to wipe them off the back of the window. So you don't have to worry so much about, oh, what's going to happen when I touch this, you know? But the first thing that I tried was, and I was relatively pleased with the effect. It was just craft store, just regular, you know, cheap acrylic artist paint, not the expensive stuff that you would necessarily get from, you know, not artist acrylics, but stuff for painting pottery and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're cheapo, okay. Very cheap. If you don't like it, big deal. You know, you know, you're not out very much. You know, and then you could thin it down. If you know, you thin it down, and then you know, if you don't want it as thick as that, just thin it down. And I wouldn't do a wash, only because you want more paint in this than you do water.
Mm-hmm.
If you're putting it on acetate, or even worse, if you were putting it on real glass.
Yeah, well, it's acetate, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In this case.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try that.
Well, this has been another phenomenal Mole Rail Radio, and letting the listenership into a little secret, I'm actually recording this 2 or 3 weeks after the show was recorded, because unfortunately the audio didn't come out quite right on my end. But anyway, it's certainly been a pleasure doing the massive editing undertaking associated with this show. And also I'd like to thank all the folks who have participated. Now, what's going to happen with the Bertie Awards is the next show is anticipated being recorded November 26th at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And that show, well, all the shows are out of whack now, and in large part it's to do with work, in large part it's to do with a move, in large part it's to do with bad audio, just a wide variety of kind of combinatory factors that have really hindered the release of this show in particular. So what I'm anticipating doing is extending the Bertie Award listener-submitted item aspect to the end of the year, and the first show in 2012, and bear in mind also that I'm going to be going to Australia over this period of time, just to add a little bit of interesting stuff to the weeks, will be the announcement of all the Berties, all the listener awards, everything associated with the Berties will be in the first show of 2012. But there will be a number of listener-submitted items ready for your vote currently, and you have a month to vote. So go to the Model Rail Radio website, you'll see the listener-submitted items up there if the show is posted after November 15th. You never know, it could come out before November 15th. You'll have the listener-submitted items up there. Email awards@modelrailradio.com. If you haven't previously voted in the previous Bertie categories, add a store, preferably a postal address or website associated with the store, because if you win the grab bag selection, what is it, $100, $50, and $225 awards going to your store of choice, so you can nominate where you want to get gift certificates, basically, to the value of, as I said, $100, $50, $25, $25. So if you haven't voted in the Bertie Awards so far, but you are going to vote in the listener submitted categories, please do include your store information so I can get those out to you if you win the gift certificates. They're going to be a wide variety of prizes. I got a wide variety of Model Rail magazines and the Model Rail Radio t-shirts and all the usual swag. And, yeah, basically I'm cleaning up and sending out junk to people. No, no, it's not like that at all. But, you know, the magazines will be going out, a wide variety of other things. You know what to do. Check out the website after November 15th if the show's been posted. We'll work it out. It'll be up on the website. Email awards@modelrailradio.com. For the listener-submitted items, a wide variety of listener-submitted items, I've got to pull that part together after I get this audio out. So a lot to be done on that front. But the next show will be November 26th. I have had a, I don't even know what you'd call it, like a roundtable show that was recorded last weekend, which I'm going to be editing and putting out in the near future as well. So please do check that out when it comes out. And yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure hosting Model Rail Radio. Apologies again for the delay in getting the show out, but unfortunately if there's audio noise, I'm just not going to put it out. I'm going to work through it, and yeah, this one's just a little bit too noisy scratching and stuff. Some of that audio has made it through to this episode, but I tried to keep it a bare minimum. So, yeah, apologies to folks if you find that particularly annoying. But I have tried to cut it out, and I have recorded a vast amount of new audio.
Goodbye, all.
Cheers.